involving fake identities, the Scottish Highlands, and some fraudulent tea.
BBC Scam Safe Week.
Across this week
on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
On FM, on digital, on BBC Sounds and your smart speaker. This is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Monday the 24th of November. This is Today with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster.
Good morning. The headlines today. Ukraine and the United States say they've agreed a new framework for peace with Russia. Can it end the war? We'll be speaking to Sir Alex Younger, the former MI6 chief and the former US ambassador to Ukraine. The BBC's chairman, Samir Shah, and the adviser who raised the alarm over editorial standards face cross-examination by MPs later today. We'll talk to a former BBC executive who thinks a lot has to change at the corporation.
Also in today's programme...
I feel I'm very lucky. I also want everyone, not just me who could go to a private doctor, but everyone who can't afford to go to a private doctor should have exactly the same screening as I have. And
that was Nick Jones speaking on our programme last year about the importance of men being screened for prostate cancer. Well, one listener, it turns out, was David Cameron, the former Prime Minister. And now, after receiving a cancer diagnosis himself, he's announced his support for that campaign. We'll speak to Nick again before 8 o'clock this morning. Filmmakers have captured what's believed to be the first ever birth of a black rhino filmed in the wild. We'll speak to the man who was there. And... It is as much a part of Christmas as the turkey and the mince pies, and today we announce our festive guest editors, including an Oscar-winning actress and a former Prime Minister. That's on the way at 7:20. Before all of that, though, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Caroline Nichols.
The White House says talks with Ukraine have made meaningful progress and an updated framework for a peace deal with Russia is now being considered. In a joint statement, US and Ukrainian officials said they had identified clear next steps. Here's our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes.
The statement is short on detail, but it says the talks were focused and respectful, with agreement that any deal must fully uphold Ukraine's sovereignty and deliver a sustainable peace. In a summary of the negotiations, the White House said the Ukrainian representatives believed the updated draft of the peace plan reflected the country's national interests, with enforceable mechanisms to safeguard its security in the near and long term. There's no indication that it addresses Ukrainian concerns over conceding territory in the eastern Donbass region to Russia. Before leaving Geneva to head back to Washington, the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio acknowledged that outstanding issues remained, but he said they were not insurmountable. Despite the initial deadline of Thursday, America's Thanksgiving holiday set by President Trump, Mr. Rubio said the talks could continue into next week.
A Russian drone strike has killed at least 4 people in Ukraine's second biggest city, Kharkiv. Local officials said the attack had set fire to 3 residential buildings. 17 people have been wounded. The employers group, the Confederation of British Industry, will call on ministers to prioritise growth and spare business from further tax rises in the budget on Wednesday. Its head, Rae Newton-Smith, is expected to tell the organisation's conference that the government needs to change course and avoid inflicting death by 1,000 taxes. Our business editor, Simon Jack, reports.
Businesses are still licking their wounds from the last budget, which saw them bear the brunt of £40 billion in tax rises. While the CBI's Director General will acknowledge some positives, including new trade deals and a clearer industrial strategy, Rae Newton-Smith will urge Rachel Reeves to refrain from further tax hikes and to bear down on obstacles to growth, including regulation, planning and the high cost of energy. The Business Secretary, Peter Carl, will promise the audience energy cost cuts for 7,000 firms. But the government shows no sign of backing down on a new employment rights bill that confers rights and protections around sick pay and unfair dismissal from day one of employment, despite many firms insisting it's discouraging hiring, a point the opposition leader Kemi Badenoch will make to the same audience.
A panel of experts has called for radical changes to the way the nuclear industry is regulated to help speed up the construction of new power stations. The task force was commissioned by the Prime Minister. In its final report, it says there should be what it calls a one-stop shop for all discussions relating to nuclear projects. Here's Graham Satchell.
When the government set up the Independent Nuclear Task Force in February, it said it wanted to rip up the rules to fire up nuclear power. Today's report claims the UK has an overly complex regulatory system, which has led to delays in building new power plants. In its 47 recommendations, it says the planning system needs to be streamlined and the risks associated with nuclear energy should be clarified. But campaign groups, including Friends of the Earth, have said it would be madness to rip up tried and tested nuclear safety rules.
Some of the central figures in the recent row about editorial standards at the BBC are to be questioned by MPs. The corporation's chairman, Samir Shah, will appear before the Commons Culture Committee alongside board members Sir Robbie Gibb and Caroline Thompson. Michael Prescott, the former editorial adviser who raised concerns about some of the BBC's reporting, will also give evidence. Here's our culture reporter, Noor Nanji.
Criticisms of the BBC have not only been about how one of President Trump's speeches was edited, but also, more widely, about claims of systemic bias and political interference. MPs on the Culture, Media and Sport Committee will hear from the corporation's chairman, Samir Shah. He's under pressure for his handling of recent events after the resignations of both the Director General and Head of News earlier this month, and then on Friday, board member Shumit Banerjee, who stepped down blaming governance issues at the very top of the broadcast. There are also likely to be questions about political appointments to the BBC board. BBC bosses will need to demonstrate to MPs they have a clear plan for the future of the corporation.
A three-year-old boy from California with a rare debilitating condition has become the first person in the world to be treated with a gene therapy developed in Manchester. Oliver Chu has Hunter syndrome, which causes progressive damage throughout the body. His parents say the treatment has given him as close to a normal life as possible. More details from our medical editor, Fergus Walsh.
Oliver Chu has astounded medical staff at Royal Manchester Children's Hospital with his rapid development in recent months. Before the treatment, the toddler was unable to produce an enzyme crucial for keeping cells healthy due to a faulty gene. In the most severe cases of Hunter syndrome, patients often don't survive beyond the age of 20. But in a world first, cells were removed from Oliver's blood and a working copy of the faulty gene designed in Manchester was inserted before the modified cells were given back to him. He's now producing the missing enzyme and has stopped all other treatment. Four other boys will receive the gene therapy as part of a trial. Doctors remain cautious, but the hope is the one-off treatment could be a permanent fix for this rare condition.
The messaging app Snapchat has started asking users in Australia to verify their age in advance of a ban on under-16s using social media. It's one of 10 platforms facing hefty fines if they don't comply with a law coming into force on the 10th of December. Snapchat has warned that disconnecting children from their friends and family may push them to apps that are less safe and less private.
Caroline, thank you very much indeed. That's a story we'll be pursuing in a little over an hour and a half's time. At coming up to 8 minutes past six, we know it's chilly, but what else can we know about the weather? Helen can tell us.
Nick, thanks. Hello, good morning. Well, it's not going to be as cold as it was last week. There will be some frosty nights to come, but by midweek, much milder for all parts. But today, northerly winds will develop. Low pressures sat in the North Sea, and that's throwing lots of rain across England and Wales this morning. A heavy band crossing northern England now, and plenty of rain across the southern half of both England and Wales. But that should all clear out into the North Sea as we go to the end of the morning, and then it will be more a case of a few sunny intervals and a scattering of showers, most likely across eastern areas and down also across parts of West Wales and South West England. But there will generally be quite a bit of cloud around today. So 6 to 8 are high, but across western parts, perhaps as high as 10 or 11, despite that north breeze. And it's really quite strong and gusty this morning along the channel around the southwest of England as well. Now to Northern Ireland. We'll just have a day of sunny intervals, in fact sunny periods, and a scattering of showers becoming more isolated into the afternoon. But again, we've got a chilly wind blowing in here as well, coming down from the north. So temperatures around about 8 or 9 degrees. And Scotland also under the influence of low pressure, particularly across eastern and central areas. Those bands of showery rain, quite heavy, snow over the tops of the Grampians, certainly. Still a few showers in the west, but probably the best of the sunshine here and across the Highland region into the afternoon. But again, it's a brisk northerly wind, so probably just 4 to 7 degrees Celsius for most. And then frost developing inland as we go through tonight.
Thank you very much, Helen. 6:09 now. Let's take a first look at the Monday morning front pages of the papers, and the Times says that the Chancellor's budget on Wednesday will bring in a property tax for homes worth more than £2 million. The surcharge, amounting to an average of £4,500, will be collected through council tax bills. It will hit apparently around 100,000 homes in total, the paper suggesting that Rachel Reeves had planned to target more properties, but has pared back the tax by raising the threshold at which it starts.
According to the Telegraph, Ms. Reeves is, in its words, planning a £15 billion welfare giveaway. It says the Chancellor will end the two-child benefit cap in its entirety and increase benefit payments in total by around 4%. The Shadow Chancellor, Mel Stride, tells the paper that the changes are being funded by what he calls the very people struggling because of higher taxes. Hard-working families.
The I newspaper reports that the Chancellor is to target universities with a tax on international student fees to fund grants for poorer British students as part of her cost of living drive. The Department for Education tells the paper the move would allow the reintroduction of maintenance grants to help more British students from poorer backgrounds.
The Express suggests analysis has shown that pensioners could be £800 a year worse off if the Chancellor extends a freeze on the income tax threshold in her budget. She's expected to keep the tax-free allowance as it is until 2030. But according to the paper, House of Commons Library research suggests the freeze would cost OAPs £7 billion a year for 2 years.
The Daily Telegraph claims that a European counter-proposal to the US peace plan for Ukraine includes moves to gradually allow Russia to be reintegrated back into the, well, the G7, which will become the G8 once again as a result. Other concessions are said to be a commitment to elections in Ukraine, which could remove President Zelensky, one of the key demands of Moscow.
According to The Guardian, the BBC is planning to create a post of Deputy Director General to help whoever replaces Tim Davey, who resigned not long ago. The move is said to be one of the measures being prepared as the fallout continues from the row over editorial standards. The BBC has not commented on that report.
And the Daily Mail, the Times, the Telegraph, the Guardian this morning all feature pictures of Lord Cameron as he highlights the push for prostate cancer screening after his own diagnosis and treatment. In his Times interview, he acknowledges there are respectable arguments against a screening programme. He says it is a really good moment, though, to have another look at one. And we will talk to Nick Jones, whose story Lord Cameron heard on the programme. And in fact, it was his wife, Samantha, hearing that story. She suggested to him that perhaps he might want to go and get checked himself. That's where the diagnosis came from. So we'll talk to Nick Jones before 8.
Yeah, it is nice to know that the conversations we have on air don't necessarily change policy. That might not be the right thing to do, but they do change people's attitudes occasionally. So more on that later. It is now 6:12.
The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has said there's been tremendous progress on a deal to try and reach a ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine, but he says there is still work to be done on it. Peter Bowes, our North America correspondent, told me how the Trump administration has been reacting to the latest round of negotiations.
Mr. Rubio has been quite cautious in terms of what he's been saying after these talks, acknowledging that there are still issues that he says are not insurmountable, but it could take several days. In fact, he speculated that they could still be talking at this time next week, which is a little bit different to what President Trump initially was suggesting. He laid out a deadline of Thursday of this week, which is the Thanksgiving holiday in America. But they seem to have softened, I think largely because they see the talks, and especially Mr. Rubio seeing those talks that we heard about on Sunday, as being very positive. And I think he wants to deflect any perhaps negative comments that we have heard from the president over the last couple of days and continue to look forward. We heard from President Trump once again talking about President Zelensky not being thankful enough, showing zero gratitude, he said, towards the US efforts to end the war, which of course simply isn't true, because we've heard repeatedly in the last few weeks and months Mr. Zelensky saying that he was grateful for the efforts of the US.
And what is being said, Peter, about the fact that the US proposal mirrors so closely what Russia might want from a deal as opposed to what Ukraine might want from a deal?
Well, what they are saying is, and in fact, the White House issued a joint statement saying that the talks had been constructive, that both sides, US and Ukrainian negotiators, agreed that there'd been meaningful progress and that a refined peace framework was now under consideration, refined from the initial 28-point peace plan, which is what you're talking about, that appeared to be so skewed towards Russia's goals. And that's the one that Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, had to clarify was written by Washington and not the Kremlin. Now, the statement does not say, in fact, there's really little detail. It doesn't say which of the points specifically have been refined. There's also a summary of the talks and a so-called readout by the White House highlighting areas of agreement, but they're not talking about those really hard-hitting areas that cause concern in Ukraine about handing over territory in the eastern Donbass region, about limiting the size of the Ukrainian military, and of pledging never to join NATO. Those issues, if they have been addressed, it hasn't been conveyed to us by the White House.
Peter Bowes, thank you.
It is now 6:15. The chairman of the BBC and the man who wrote the memo, which was leaked criticising the BBC's editorial failures, faced cross-questioning by MPs today, amongst others. It could be a difficult day for the corporation. Yet another one. Our culture reporter, Noor Nanji, will be watching. Morning to you, Noor. What do you think MPs are likely to focus on in these hearings?
Morning, Nick. Well, there has been a lot of drama, hasn't there, over the last few weeks, from the leaked memo to the resignations to the apology over the Panorama edit and then the threat of legal action by President Trump. But today, as you say, MPs are going to get their chance to speak to some of the main players in this story. So this is the Culture, Media and Sport Committee. They'll be hearing this afternoon from people, including the BBC chair, Samir Shah. Now, he is facing pressure, even anger from some, after losing, of course, two senior executives under his watch, Tim Davey and Deborah Ternes. And then on Friday, he was hit with another resignation by the board member, Shamit Banerjee, who quit blaming governance issues at the very top of the corporation. Now, that resignation looked like a direct critique of Samir Shah. And while, of course, he does have his supporters, I think there are now some who are questioning his ability to remain in the job. And then there will also be questions to two former editorial advisors to the BBC, including Michael Prescott, who wrote that leaked memo that kicked all of this off in the first place. And that memo raised questions not only about the edits of Donald Trump's speech, but also it made claims of systemic bias at the BBC. This is the first time he's discussing all of that in public, and we can expect he'll be questioned about his involvement in all of it. And then I think we can also expect questions about how the BBC board is made up, and whether it is too political, because there's been a lot of talk about that in recent weeks. And that's something that MPs might explore with BBC board members Sir Robbie Gibb and Caroline Thompson.
And there may be some suggestion of what the BBC intends to do about it, or what the chairman of the BBC intends to do about it, to make this whole process work more effectively.
That's right. I mean, there's been lots of speculation about what they may or may not do. I mean, The Guardian has an article out today, as we're hearing a bit earlier in the programme. It's suggesting that the BBC is looking to expand its editorial guidelines and standards committee. And we do understand that to be accurate. And it is possible that just having a bigger cast, more people on that committee, will help it to scrutinise issues better and ensure that no one individual can dominate proceedings. And The Guardian also reports that the BBC will look to add a new deputy director general role after concerns that it's just become too much to run the organisation for just one person. I mean, it is worth saying that there have been deputy director generals before, until quite recently. So it would be reintroducing a role that has already existed in the past. Now, there's been no comment, we should say, from the BBC press office on this. But I think what is clear, that is, in order to lead the BBC out of this crisis, BBC bosses do need to demonstrate a clear plan to MPs today.
Noor Nanji, thank you very much. Those hearings at about 3:30 this afternoon.
It's 6:18. Now, the chief executive of Vodafone has told us that she believes not spots, basically those bits of the country where you still struggle to get a mobile phone signal, could be virtually eliminated by the end of next year. Will Baines got more on that and the rest of the business news. Morning, Will.
Morning, Anna. Morning, Nick. Yeah, often highly enraging, aren't they, those areas? Or frankly, too, pretty serious impediment to running your business still in parts of the country. It seems almost amazing that as big mobile operators roll out faster 5G signal in some places, there are still significant chunks of the country that count as not spots. So as part of our conversation with the Vodafone Chief Executive, Margherita Della Valle, we also asked why it was taking so long to tackle the problem and a bit more about how its recent merger with Three might impact its customers.
The UK ranks number 22 out of 25 countries in Europe for the quality and the reach of its telecom infrastructure. And Europe itself, by the way, is by no means leading the world. And I think you experience this every day, particularly in those areas which we call not spots, where actually you go completely out of coverage. There are quite a few still in the UK, and the key objective of the 11 billion infrastructure project that we have just launched is eliminating those not spots and bringing coverage to the whole of the population.
Why has it taken so long then, though? What has held it up? Why has it been so slow?
Insufficient investment because of lack
Simple as that.
Catch. Exactly. Simple as that. The good news, I think, is that this is really changing fast. The merger was completed less than 6 months ago. By the end of this year, fiscal year, for us it's March 26, we will have eliminated not spots in the UK for an area equivalent to 10 times the size of London. And on top of that, we want, as fast as possible, to fill in any gap, also leveraging the power of satellites now that will give coverage also, for example, on the sea. We have been working with a satellite company to make this possible since 2019.
This is AST. Tell us a bit more about that.
AST Space Mobile, yes. A startup that developed a technology that will allow us to give a full broadband connection on normal phones. Today in the UK, if you want satellite connectivity, you need to buy some special equipment, you need a dish. What's really important for us is to allow people with the normal phone they have in their pockets when they end up out of coverage for whatever reasons to have a backup.
So what was your sense for the date of no more not spots in the UK?
The merger itself, from a terrestrial network perspective, will bring coverage to 99.95% of the UK population. And this is with the terrestrial network. The infill of satellites will build from next year.
The other key element of the merger was all about price, wasn't it? Basically, how much people would pay for their phone contracts going forward as a result of this. In the final deal that went through, the CMA set some caps on certain types of fares, didn't they, for 3 years. What happens at the end of those 3 years to those fares, to those tariffs?
I think you will have seen in the conclusion of the CMAs that they agreed with us that actually the merger is not just going to be good in terms of better quality infrastructure, but will also be good for competition. Their words, not mine.
They did initially say that they thought it was almost certain that prices would go up for a certain number of those consumers in the medium term.
If you read the papers, of course, it took 2 years for the whole process to get through. And of course, the starting point was we need to make sure that prices don't go up. Mm-hmm. And they needed to assess that risk. Now, the conclusion was that this risk doesn't exist. And I'll try and explain it in a nutshell. Competition on prices in the mobile industry is not going to change as a result of the merger. This is because there are dozens of different brands competing for customers in the UK market, not just the network operators, but you have big brands like Tesco, like Sky. We are talking of dozens of brands on the retail side that are competing, and this competition will not change. What will change is that then these brands will have the choice of three well-invested networks to play with that they didn't have today.
But presumably when that cap comes off, right, won't the costs that then go down to a Sky, someone who uses your network, for example, that will change, won't it?
No, it won't. And the reason why there is a cap or there are references on pricing for the first phase is to let us time to really build the network. But once that capacity is on the ground, we will be, together with the other telecom network operators, wanting to fill that capacity and compete. If you get the scale to get the appropriate return on that investment, the more we invest, the more we grow. And this is now the situation of Vodafone, by the way, not just in the UK with the merger, but across all the markets in which we operate. As I mentioned earlier, the starting point for for the UK is not an easy one because there has been underinvestment. But this is going to change fast, and it's essential for the UK and for older countries to get this fast speed network coming through. Businesses need to access increasingly more network-heavy technologies. Everyone is now talking about AI, for example, and AI will need good networks.
Yeah, really good, right? Like, I mean, we're talking like these large language models, a ChatGPT, a Gemini, whatever it is, they hit like thousands of pages, right? Tens of thousands of internet pages. If we all suddenly started using, all 60 million of us across the UK suddenly started using ChatGPT all the time for everything, would our networks hold up?
I think we have made very good progress on the fixed side of networks, and a lot of the communication you describe are essentially going through big pipes across data centers. Where we have more to do is our mobile infrastructure, because people will want to be able to access AI, exchange videos with AI every day. And for that, we need more progress. I mean, the good news is that, as I was mentioning earlier, we are actually now putting the investment on the ground to make this possible.
And round us out back in Europe again then, because you're in a funny space, that's probably the wrong word, an interesting space, and you're a pan-European company, and yet we're sort of competing with Europe as well in terms of our attractiveness as a place to invest and all those kind of things. Well, you talked a lot about the merger that you've had here in the UK. Is that potentially an area where we can compete as a country by making regulation easier for people like yourselves to do deals like that, to try and then build up the investment that you've been chatting to us about through the interview?
Today, the UK in this field of regulation for telecoms is leading by example. We see the regulatory environment in the EU also set for a change. I think it will follow the example that the UK has opened up with our merger. Thinking about the UK and Europe, though, you use the word competition. I would also put on the table the word cooperation, because we were talking earlier about how critical the security and resilience of our infrastructure is. To give you just a practical example, Vodafone is the largest player across the whole of Europe on submarine cables. We are one of the top 10 carriers of the world's internet traffic with our networks internationally. It does make sense in areas like this to actually cooperate across border within Europe for better security and resilience, so that we can piggyback on each other within Europe to ensure that our networks are always resilient and effective, even in a time of crisis.
And now, more than ever, with the threat that we've seen from Russia to those cables and all that kind of stuff as well, it's not optional to work together anymore when you're trying to...
I think when you're managing at scale an international service like ours, it's really important, wherever possible in this day and age, to actually join forces with your neighbours.
That's the Chief Executive of Vodafone, Margherita Della Valle, and plenty more on the Big Boss interview podcast, which you can find on Sounds or, of course, wherever else you get a podcast from. Well, Jane Foley is also with us this morning. Jane's the Head of FX Strategy at the bank Rabobank. Jane, morning.
Good morning.
And I was struck really as Nick and Anna went through the papers there as well, and you could go down even more of the front pages. You've got seven or eight front pages with seven or eight different, completely different areas of potential budget policy and potential budget changes. Is that in and of itself the issue here for investors?
Yeah, you know, it's uncertainty we know is not good for investors, because it's very difficult to know how to place your money if you don't know how you're going to be taxed, etc., down the line. So the fact that this budget is so late has been, you know, part of the criticism that's been wielded at this government. That said, the uncertainty did rise again a couple of weeks ago, or just over a week ago, really, when there was speculation that income tax would not, after all, be raised. I think markets had thought that that was going to be the main solution. So now, again, a lot of speculation as to which web of which taxes could be used instead.
Yeah, and because people are going to be watching that closely this week, take us to the bond market then. Where are we as we start the week, and put it in some context?
Well, we did have that wobble just over a week ago when we saw that report that, after all, it may not be income tax, be the main tax that the Chancellor would use to close her fiscal gap. But we've got to say that borrowing costs are off their summer highs. And the main reason for that is because of this perception that maybe we are now past the peak of inflation in the UK, and that may give the Bank of England a bit more room to cut interest rates, maybe as soon as December.
Right. So that interest rate hope is sort of balancing a little bit of the uncertainty that you talked about.
Yes, correct.
Elsewhere then, let's look at a couple of bit of corporate news too, because this will they, won't they merger that's been going on for some time now between two of the biggest mining firms in the world, BHP and Anglo American, now looks this morning as though BHP stepping back once again from that, but does talk about kind of consolidation in that sector, doesn't it, and the need for scale with the sort of rush for rare earth minerals and that kind of stuff as well.
Yes, and particularly copper. So this deal was really undermined or underpinned, I should say, by copper, because copper, of course, is crucial to electrification. And that is, of course, the way the world seems to be going. So what we've had this morning is Anglo-American said to reject BHP's proposal. And that was a proposal that was only on the table for a day or two. But of course, we all know that BHP in 2024 had already tried to take over Anglo, and they then walked away. And since then, things have changed. So Anglo is having talks with Teck, and they're due to vote on that in a couple of weeks' time. That's a Canadian company about creating a new copper giant. And it seems that that is the way that Anglo wants to go.
Jane, thanks for your time this morning. Jane Foley, Head of FX Strategy at Rabobank.
Well, thank you very much indeed. Quite a day in North London yesterday. Mike's here with the sports
news. Absolutely, Nick. Yes, I think we have to start, don't we, with the first hat-trick in a North London derby for almost 50 years.
Comes back to Ezra on the edge of the box. Oh, he scored! Brilliant touch from Ezra! Ezra with another chance. Ezra shoots and scores! It's a second for him! Oh, lovely from Ezra. Oh, he scored! This is a Berrettini Ezra's North London derby. It's a hat-trick!
Yeah, special day, man. Special day for me, my family. I can only thank God for the opportunity to be here, to be working and applying myself every day. And, yeah, happy to help the team to win today.
Yes, for the first time since Alan Sunderland in 1978, we saw a hat-trick in the North London derby yesterday, and it was that man, Eberechi Eze, who scored it, the Arsenal man, helping his side beat rivals Tottenham, the team he almost joined in the summer, by 4-1. So an afternoon to forget for Spurs fans. Here's a calm, reasoned response from one of them.
I've been a Spurs fan for 37 years. That is the worst turnout from a Spurs team I have ever seen. It's a disgraceful performance from the boys. Disgraceful.
That was shocking. That killed the North London derby. Disgraceful. Football's dead. Football's dead.
Just one caller to 606 on 5 Live. That was in the immediate aftermath. I hope he's calmed down a little bit there. But it has left Arsenal 6 points clear at the top of the Premier League table this morning. Elsewhere, Leeds lost again 2-1 at home to Aston Villa. There was a first defeat of the season too for Scottish Premiership leaders Hearts. They were beaten 1-0 by Aberdeen. Away from football briefly, let's just round up the rest of the weekend sport with some other key numbers. Starting with 11, that's the number of wins in a row now for the England rugby team.
Given a scare though, weren't they? 11 test wins in a row, unbeaten at home in 2025. Twickenham is bouncing, but boy, that was tense.
Yes, they held on to beat Argentina 27-23 at Twickenham yesterday to make it 4 wins from 4 this autumn and 11 in a row. Another significant number this morning is 24. That's the number of points Lando Norris's lead at the top of the Formula One driver's standings has been cut to after the McLaren driver was disqualified from the Las Vegas Grand Prix yesterday following a technical infringement with his car. Max Verstappen won the race, meaning with 2 rounds to go, the title is still up for grabs. Here's BBC commentator Harry Benjamin.
Lando Norris looks set to have one hand on this world championship. He could have clinched it in the sprint race in Qatar next weekend. But now this puts, well, Norris on 390 points, 24 ahead of Piastri and Verstappen, who are now tied on points. So whilst momentum is still very much with Lando Norris, it's brought Max Verstappen well and truly back into this fight.
The penultimate round of the Formula One season is in Qatar, and the final number I'll leave you with this morning is number 3, after Italy won tennis's Davis Cup for the third time in a row yesterday, beating Spain in the final in Bologna.
Thank you, Mike.
Snuggle up by an old stone fireplace and enjoy a cup of cocoa.
Christmas films on BBC iPlayer.
Here we are on the run-up to Christmas.
Christmas.
Excellent.
Great. Big whoopee. If you're not feeling festive yet...
No, not as such.
Oh. Spark your Christmas spirit.
Make this a good one
with Nativity.
Are we ready to give it a go?
The Holiday.
Okay, let's go.
Bridget Jones's Diary.
That's the one.
And more.
Sounds perfect.
festive film favourites on BBC iPlayer.
And you get the Christmas Today editors unveiled today as well. I mean, what could you want, really? Yeah. The time now is, 27 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson. And Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
The United States and Ukraine have given a positive account of their talks in Geneva on ending the war with Russia. The White House said the consultations reaffirmed that any future agreement must fully uphold Ukraine's sovereignty and deliver a sustainable and just peace, while a senior Ukrainian negotiator said the current version of the blueprint now reflected most of Ukraine's key priorities. Ukrainian officials say Russia has carried out a massive drone attack on the eastern city of Kharkiv. At least 4 people have been killed and a further 17 injured. The employers group, the CBI, will call on ministers to spare business from further tax rises in the budget as its annual conference gets underway. Its director general is expected to tell delegates the government needs to bear down on obstacles to growth, including regulation, planning and high energy costs. A task force commissioned by the Prime Minister is calling for radical changes to the way the nuclear industry is regulated. Its report says the UK has an overly complex system which delays new power plants being built. Environmental groups say it would be madness to rip up tried and tested nuclear safety rules. The former Prime Minister Lord Cameron says he's been successfully treated for prostate cancer. He told The Times he'd received electrical pulse therapy to destroy cancer cells. Some of the key figures in a row about editorial standards at the BBC are to be questioned by MPs. Those appearing before the Commons Culture Committee include the corporation's chairman, 2 board members and a former editorial advisor who raised concerns about some of the BBC's reporting. A 3-year-old boy from California who has the rare debilitating condition Hunter syndrome has become the first person in the world to be treated with a gene therapy developed in Manchester. His parents say the treatment has given him as close to a normal life as possible.
Thank you, Caroline. We'll hear from his dad in the next hour of the programme this morning. It is 25 to 7 now. Let's turn to Ukraine because American, Ukrainian, European negotiators have all been meeting together in Geneva to work on a peace plan to end the war between Ukraine and Russia. The leaked US proposal was heavily weighted in favour of Russia, but President Zelensky says there were signals that Donald Trump's team was hearing the Ukrainian side. Sarah Rainsford is our correspondent in Geneva. Sarah, morning. What are they hoping to do to this proposal to make it acceptable to all?
I think there was a huge amount of work done yesterday here in Geneva, a whole day of meetings in all sorts of formats, lots of delegates, lots of delegations zipping back and forth between the two main venues. And clearly there was a huge amount to discuss because, as you say, the first draft proposal that they came here to talk about was very, very controversial. In fact, so controversial, so skewed towards Russia's demands that, in fact, Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State for the US, had to come out and say, no, this was written by Washington. It wasn't written by Moscow. So quite extraordinary as a starting point for discussions. But certainly yesterday evening, it was after about 8:30 in the evening here when Marco Rubio emerged from those talks, he was trying to sound as positive as possible. He said that huge progress had been made, tremendous, he said. And he described that the proposal, this peace proposal, as a living, breathing document, something that is changing. I think really what we saw yesterday happening, and it was all happening behind closed doors and lots of people very tight-lipped about the actual details, I think what was happening was essentially Ukraine, with the helping of European officials, pushing back against that initial draft proposal. Because, of course, you'll remember Donald Trump was really piling on the pressure on Ukraine, saying that they had a deadline of next Thursday to agree to this deal, basically, or else. And now it looks that has changed. The deadline has shifted. The paper itself, the document itself, is changing. And Ukraine has come out of a day of talk saying it does see that its key priorities are being reflected in that document. But I do think we're still a very long way off that actually being agreed. This is a huge demand, a huge ask of Ukraine, and you know, forming a final document that at least could be acceptable to Ukraine and its European backers, I think that is still a challenge.
Does Russia have any involvement in these talks, Sarah? Because, of course, we face the possibility that the document is changed so it works for Ukraine, but then Russia rejects it.
Yeah, that's obviously still a real key possibility. Whether Russia has any involvement, well, they did look to have quite a lot of involvement in the initial document. Ukraine has obviously pushed back, and as I say, I think Europe's role has been critical there, because Europe again was sidelined initially, but has piled in to these talks. I think, you know, Ukraine feels that it has to be seen to be engaging with this process as Donald Trump has demanded. It really wants to make the point that Ukraine wants peace more than anyone. You know, Ukraine is interested, of course, in doing a deal, but that Ukraine has one fundamental demand, and that is that it gets proper, robust security guarantees. It needs the United States to ensure and to commit to basically coming in and helping Ukraine in such a way, in such robust language and so convincingly, that Russia, after any peace deal, would never invade Ukraine again. And I think, you know, when everything else is put to one side, that is what Ukraine needs to be sure of before it can really sign up to some kind of a final settlement. And yet, of course, you know, Russia can always say no. I think what Ukraine wants is for Russia to be the one that is creating obstacles to peace, and to make sure that is what happens, rather than Ukraine not engaging with this process.
Sarah Rainsford in Geneva, where those talks are taking place. Thank you. Much more to come on that story between now and nine.
Coming up to 22:07 now. Spare us from more taxes. Prioritise growth. That is the plea coming from the business organisation, the CBI, this morning, ahead of their conference today and just 2 days ahead of the budget. We're going to hear from the boss of the CBI in the next hour of the programme. Let's talk first to Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent. Morning, Henry. In essence, this is a question about what this budget is for and who it's directed at, isn't it?
Exactly right. And the government's response to the CBI's call at this conference today will come from Peter Kyle, the business secretary. He will say that this government is all about growth, promising to remove what he'll call the millstone of government to free up business to drive growth. And he'll try to inject a bit of optimism as well, promising boldness, creativity and urgency. That's the message to business. To Labour MPs, perhaps inevitably, it's a touch different. MPs are being told in the run-up to Wednesday's budget that it will protect the lowest earners. We are expecting the full abolition of the two-child benefit cap. I think important to stress that is massively popular among Labour MPs who are not just on the left of the party. We're also expecting new taxes on wealth, even if it's not a capital W, capital T wealth tax, including on property wealth. And that does, as you say, Nick, get to the big question that will be answered this week. Is this budget's number one priority growth, or is its number one priority living standards? And since we're talking about a budget in the week of a CBI conference, perhaps just worth noting that it was at the CBI conference last year, 364 days ago exactly, when Rachel Reeves said, "I'm not coming back with more borrowing or more taxes."
Yeah, I sense she might be reminded of that quote once or twice by the leader of the opposition, who is also speaking at the CBI today and saying, in essence, isn't she, if you really think growth matters, what on earth are you putting more workers' rights onto the agenda for, which will add to the cost of businesses?
Exactly right. She will call on the government, as she has done before, to scrap the Employment Rights Bill, which was one of the flagship measures of this government's first period in office. It's actually still going through Parliament, very nearly there. It's in the final stages of back and forth between the House of Lords and the House of Commons. Kemi Badenoch will say, when I visit business and ask them what most causes anxiety, they talk about the government's Employment Rights Bill. Now, worth remembering, I think this is still a bit underappreciated, Nick, that some of the key provisions in this legislation, even once the bill is law, go out to consultation. So there is still a pretty wide spectrum of ways in which this legislation could end up operating in practice. So that is one to watch.
We will be. I know you will be before us. Henry Zeffman, thank you.
18 minutes to seven now. A special gene therapy developed in Manchester has been used for the first time on a three-year-old boy from California. Oliver Chu has a rare condition called Hunter syndrome, which causes progressive damage throughout the body. Fergus Walsh joins us, our medical editor. Morning, Fergus.
Morning. This is an absolutely lovely story to report on, Anna. So we've been following Oliver Chu's progress for the past year. So we were there at Royal Manchester Children's Hospital in December when he had his blood filtered to remove stem cells. These were sent to labs at Great Ormond Street Hospital in London, where a working copy of his faulty gene was inserted, And in February, Oliver had an infusion of this gene therapy. Now, what that allowed was it meant that his body could start producing a crucial missing enzyme that in boys, and this condition usually only affects boys, it's very rare, progressive damage to cells throughout the body is caused because of this missing enzyme. Well, Oliver is now producing the enzyme. He's come off all other treatment and he's doing very well.
That's brilliant. We're going to hear from his dad later in the programme as well. And so what, I mean, people will also wonder, Fergus, when they hear about breakthroughs like this, what else could be done with that technology?
Sure. Well, staff at Royal Manchester Children's Hospital are cautious, but they hope this could be a permanent fix for Hunter syndrome. Five boys from around the world are going to have this pioneering treatment. So it's early days. They'll be followed for a few years. There is another licensed treatment for another single gene disorder called MLK. That treatment comes in at over £2 million. But it's using the body to effectively repair itself by inserting this faulty gene. So there is evidence that it works. It is being tried in a couple of other single gene disorders. But it is marvellous news that this treatment developed in Manchester over 15 years. And this trial, not funded by the pharmaceutical industry, but funded by a medical charity called LifeArc. It's wonderful that this first child now has been successfully treated.
Yeah, always good to start the week on a positive story. Fergus Walsh, thank you.
It's a quarter to seven now. It's 6 weeks since the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. Whilst more aid is now entering Gaza, the World Food Programme says it's been getting in only about two-thirds of the volume of food supplies that it had hoped, and that there are still access constraints. With the help of our freelancers in Gaza, we've been speaking to an aid worker at a community kitchen run by the US aid organisation called ANERA, ANERA, to see what has changed. Here's our Middle East correspondent, Yolan Nell.
Garlic is simmering in huge pots set up in a long line heated over open wood fires. What's being prepared here isn't just lunch, it's a lifeline. This community kitchen opened in Azawada in central Gaza after the ceasefire. 40 cooks now serve up food daily for thousands of displaced people living in nearby camps who rely on it.
We increase up to 120 pots in a day, targeting more than 30 IDPs camps, serving more than 4,000 families, compared to just 900 families 6 months ago.
Taste testing the dish, Sami Matar works for American Near East Refugee Aid, ANERA, which runs two kitchens, working with another US humanitarian organization, World Central Kitchen. But while more food is getting into Gaza than it did before, there are vital ingredients missing to improve people's diets.
We are mostly confined to cook just three types of meals in a week: rice, pasta, and lentil. We need the food to be more diverse and to secure essential protein like meat and chicken. Those essentials are not allowed to enter Gaza for humanitarian aid distribution.
On the menu today, it's spaghetti, made with canned vegetables and tomato sauce and flavoured with herbs and spices. An increase in fuel allowed into Gaza means ANERA can use a lorry to get the meal to camps where children are already queuing for the handouts. The pasta is a popular choice. A little red-haired boy shows his delight. I'm happy because of the kitchen, he says, because there's sweet corn and everything. Other children, grinning, sit on the ground and start tucking into their families' rations, eating with their fingers. ANERA has a list of those vetted to receive aid in the tent camps. Most people, like Aida Salha, come from northern Gaza. They've had their homes destroyed in the war, lost loved ones, and have no savings left.
We eat the food available from the soup kitchen. We live off it. I swear, nothing's changed since the ceasefire. We were only happy because the constant bloodshed had stopped.
The UN has already confirmed famine in parts of Gaza. With the onset of winter, life has been getting harder. A week ago, camps were flooded by heavy rain. Aid agencies are pressing for all the border crossings to be opened by Israel to bring in more supplies. For now, aid workers like Sami Matar do their best.
The conversation we have with the family in the camps are heartbreaking. The overwhelming feeling is one of the deep uncertainty and exhaustion. Most of them are focused on survival from one day to the next, how to keep their children warm and fed, especially in the winter season.
The ceasefire in Gaza remains shaky, and Palestinians are sceptical about the international peace plan. Still, with no other good options, they desperately need it to work.
As Yolande Nell reporting, it's 11 minutes to 7 now. A new set of rules to speed up the building of nuclear power stations is being called for in a new report that's released this morning. The Prime Minister commissioned an independent task force to look at the process, and it found an overly complex regulatory system, which is basically making things too slow and too expensive. John Fingleton is the author of that report, the chair of the task force. Good morning.
Good morning.
Tell me a bit more about what you found when you looked into this in depth.
Well, this is the most comprehensive review of nuclear regulation, looking at civil and defence, environment planning and safety regulation. And we found that the system is overly complex. The building of nuclear power stations involves many different regulatory regimes, and each one has over time become more and more slow and cautious, to the point where it's made us the most expensive place in the world to build nuclear. It is pushing up our energy costs. You have other stories on your news this morning about the government subsidising industrial energy users. We have the highest industrial energy costs in the world. And all of that, I think, a lot of it is due to excessive regulation.
How does our system compare to the ones they have in other countries?
So firstly, our nuclear safety, our radiation or radiological safety regulations are way stricter than in any other of the partner countries we have. Even in the nuclear energy setting, they are stricter than they are in the medical setting. So the rules on how much radiation you'd be exposed to in a dentist or a doctor are way more relaxed. We have a system called As Low As Reasonably Practical, and it says constantly try to get safer. And it's a bit like if you're on the motorway and people say, well, 70 miles an hour is not that safe, let's do 60. And then at 60, people say, well, be safer still at 50. And eventually we get to the stage where we're all driving at 5 miles an hour. And motorways wouldn't be very useful if we all drove at 5 miles an hour. But that's sort of what we're doing in nuclear safety.
There will be people inevitably listening to this and thinking, but hang on a minute, don't we have really stringent safety procedures in nuclear power for a reason? You're not suggesting sweeping those away?
Absolutely not. I mean, what we're doing is a very forensic examination of what the rules should be. We've recommended on safety that our rules should be the same as the international standards that our main trading partners use. We've suggested changes to environmental and planning regulation to speed things up. We have examples in the report, and people know about the famous Bat Tunnel on HS2. But we see that we spend 700 million protecting some fish in the Severn Estuary. The number of fish protected is way less than expected, but 700 million is a lot of money to be protecting. I think it's one salmon every 10 years.
So you've produced this. Now you want it to be implemented, presumably. What happens next? Now this has been handed over to the government. And we did say that it was the Prime Minister that had commissioned this. So presumably you're expecting, you know, a degree of this at least to be taken on board.
I think for this to work, the government needs to implement all of the report. And my expectation is they will say something about that in the budget this week. We have AI and other tech investors want more energy in the UK. The government needs to send a very clear signal that it's committed to implementing this if we want to build that investor confidence.
You said you've got an expectation it'll be mentioned in the budget. Have you got any guarantees or have those conversations been had?
I'd be very disappointed if the government doesn't fully implement implement the recommendations in the budget.
John Fingleton, the chair of that task force, thank you for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wonder if he's had a nod or a wink. We won't ask you. We won't put you in that embarrassing position.
A very angry debate. It's a very retaliation in first.
It's a version of a nod or a wink. It's 7 minutes to seven now. The waiting is almost over. The budget is, after all, only 2 days away. But are we already paying a price for the long, long wait filled by endless budget leaks and semi-public changes of mind coming from Treasury ministers? The former chief economist of the Bank of England, Andy Haldane, has condemned what he called the fiscal fandango, which has damaged the the economy. I've been speaking to a friend of the programme, the chief economic advisor, Ali Ans, Mohammed Al-Arian, and asked him what evidence there was for this.
There are a number of data points that suggest that prolonged speculation has flatlined growth. You see this in the latest retail sales numbers, which were the first decline since May. You see this in the decline of business confidence and consumer sentiment. And there's general agreement that the economy has paid a price for a process that has been delayed, that has been full of speculation, and that has seen the government send conflicting signals.
What ministers say is they've been preparing the ground with the public, with the markets, for the fact that tax will have to go up. Isn't that a reasonable thing to do?
It is, and they have been preparing the ground. The question is, how long do you prepare the ground for? Look, a budget has a journey and a destination. If you make the journey complex, if the journey seems to some as chaotic, then your destination becomes harder to achieve. And that is the risk that the government is facing. It can overcome it by being decisive on budget day, but it has made hard choices even harder.
Be decisive means what in this case? Go bigger? Be more willing to invest, as you and a series of other economists like Gus O'Donnell and Jim O'Neill said in an important letter that was published a few weeks ago?
Yes. Budgets should not be narrow fiscal accounting exercises. They should be an economic event. They should be aiming at both fiscal sustainability and economic growth. They should be packaged in a pro-growth context that emphasizes the need for investment. Otherwise, you end up chasing your own tail. And that's what has happened. The Chancellor inherited a very difficult situation. It was made more difficult by external developments and by own goals. And now this budget is, in fact, harder than the budget she had to introduce just after the election.
And you think that is her fault, or partly her fault at least, because of the previous tax rises and because the endless speculation has stopped people investing in Britain?
I think if she looks back, she probably would want to do a few things differently. First, not overburden the national insurance contribution by employers, because that has a negative impact on jobs and growth. Second, she probably should have introduced the budget more quickly after the election. And third, the government should not have tied its hands as much as it did during the election campaign by saying no to certain large taxes. The alternative, Nick, is a cocktail of taxes that gets a lot of people confused and doesn't have a central message that allows people to buy in. You need society to buy into the budget, because we have no choice but to embark on this difficult journey. And if people don't buy into the destination, then they're going to resist the journey.
Mohammed Al-Arian, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Much more on the budget, of course, in the days to come, and more coming up in the next hour on what we're always excited about, Anna, at this time of year, the Christmas guest editors.
Yes.
Do you know who you've got? You're not allowed to say.
Oh, well, no, are we? Because I'd spotted a little leak this morning that it might be out there already. But one thing I would say I'm quite excited about mine.
Yeah.
But you're allowed to say you're excited.
There are some big names coming up, not least Helen Willis, who's here with us.
Are you wanting the weather now this morning?
Yes,
would you like a slight taste of what's happening outside the window? If you look outside the window right now here in London, it's absolutely pouring it down. And that's really a sign of what's to come for most of the UK through the day ahead. So slow pressure with us again. And despite the week becoming much milder, we are starting on a chilly note. The wind's coming down from the north or the northeast today, and it's really quite brisk as well, particularly around the southwest of England and the Channel at the moment. So for England and Wales, a real mixed bag this morning. We've got lines of really quite heavy rain across the southern half of England and Wales, and another line of really heavy rain making its way southwards across northern England, south of Lancaster now, but north of Liverpool, right the way across to Scarborough. Really heavy over the Trans-Pennine routes. So that is all going to clear its way out into the North Sea. Sunny spells and scattered showers following on behind as we go into the afternoon. But sunshine at a premium. It's most likely, I think, across western areas. But we'll still have showers coming down through Pembrokeshire and into Cornwall. And these showers are really quite heavy because there's still that energy left in the sea at this time of year. And that brisk and chilly north wind limiting our temperatures to 6 to 8. We might get 9 or 10 right on the west coast. Then, as we go to Northern Ireland and Scotland, fewer showers in the west here, but some sunshine coming through in western areas, heavier showers further east with some snow over the mountains.
I'm David Cannadine, and in a new series for Radio 4, I'm exploring the objects and emblems that embody the British Constitution.
There is no greater symbol of national unity than our Union Jack.
In each episode, I'll be uncovering the stories behind these different materials of state and asking how they speak to the past, present and future of British political history.
They're always going to be sources of discussion, debate and disagreement.
Materials of State begins this afternoon at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 24th of November. The headlines this morning: Ukraine and the United States have given a positive assessment of their latest negotiations, saying they'd agreed a revised framework for a peace deal with Russia. The former editorial adviser who raised concerns about the BBC's journalism will be questioned this afternoon by MPs. And David Cameron has joined calls for a targeted screening programme for prostate cancer after revealing he's been treated for the disease.
Coming up in the next hour of the programme, as Australia bans social media for under-16s, we hear from one MP there who says that tech-savvy teens will always find a workaround.
Kids are going to work out how to get around it. So they're still going to be accessing social media, but it's going to be an underground social media. They've started off their life breaking the law.
And Christmas is coming, and with it, the Today Christmas guest editors. And each year they bring some slightly different stories, some things we might otherwise miss. And this year is no different.
I don't think there's ever been an item about Japanese toilet ghosts. So that is another gap that I will be filling. Mm.
Just one of our guest editors. All will be revealed in about 20 minutes' time here on the programme. Before that, the BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
The White House says talks with Ukraine have made meaningful progress and an updated framework for a peace deal with Russia is now being considered. In a joint statement, American and Ukrainian officials said they'd identified clear next steps. The US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, said negotiations could continue into next week. Our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, reports from Geneva, where the discussions are being held.
Marco Rubio came out of hours of talks here to announce tremendous progress, as he put it, and insist there were just a couple of issues that would be resolved. But he wouldn't go into any details. And other reports suggest European officials have helped Kiev push back against some key points of his proposed peace deal. Ukraine is engaging with this process because it can't afford to lose US support and because Kiev really does want peace. But there is one demand on which it can't compromise. Ukraine needs the US to give the most robust possible security guarantees so that once this war is over, Russia never dares invade again. And it doesn't have that yet. The US Secretary of State said he would love an agreement to be reached by Thursday, as Donald Trump initially demanded. But he said the new deadline was as soon as possible.
In Ukraine, at least four people have been killed in an extensive Russian drone attack on the eastern city of Kharkiv. Its mayor said 15 strikes were recorded in six areas. The city is close to the Russian border and has been frequently targeted since Russia failed to capture it at the start of the war. The employers group, the Confederation of British Industry, will call on ministers to prioritise growth and spare business from further tax rises in the budget on Wednesday. The head of the CBI, Rae Newton-Smith, is expected to tell her organisation's conference that the government needs to change course and avoid inflicting death by a thousand taxes. Our business editor, Simon Jack, reports.
Businesses are still licking their wounds from the last budget, which saw them bear the brunt of £40 billion in tax rises. While the CBI's Director General will acknowledge some positives, including new trade deals and a clearer industrial strategy, Ray Newton-Smith will urge Rachel Reeves to refrain from further tax hikes and to bear down on obstacles to growth, including regulation, planning and the high cost of energy. The Business Secretary, Peter Carl, will promise the audience energy cost cuts for 7,000 firms. But the government shows no sign of backing down on a new employment rights bill that confers rights and protections around sick pay and unfair dismissal from day one of employment, despite many firms insisting it's discouraging hiring, a point the opposition leader Kemi Badenoch will make to the same audience.
A panel of experts has called for radical changes to the way the nuclear industry is regulated to help speed up the construction of new power stations. The task force was commissioned to look at the current system by the Prime Minister. In its final report, it says there should be what it calls a one-stop shop for all decisions relating to nuclear projects. Rachel Reeves will respond to the recommendations in the budget. Here's Graham Satchell.
When the government set up the Independent Nuclear Task Force in February, it said it wanted to rip up the rules to fire up nuclear power. Today's report claims the UK has an overly complex regulatory system, which has led to delays in building new power plants. In its 47 recommendations, the task force says the planning system needs to be streamlined and the risks associated with nuclear energy should be clarified and brought in line with the rest of the world. The Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, has welcomed the findings, saying reforms are needed to drive forward new nuclear in a safe and affordable way. But campaign groups, including Friends of the Earth, have said it would be madness to rip up tried and tested nuclear safety rules.
Some of the central figures in the recent row about editorial standards at the BBC are preparing to be questioned by MPs. The corporation's chairman, Samir Shah, will appear before the Commons Culture Committee alongside board members Sir Robbie Gibb and Caroline Thompson. Michael Prescott, the former editorial adviser who raised concerns about some of the BBC's reporting, will also give evidence. Here's our culture reporter, Nornanji.
Criticisms of the BBC have not only been about how one of President Trump's speeches was edited, but also, more widely, about claims of systemic bias and political interference. MPs on the Culture, Media and Sport Committee will hear from the corporation's chairman, Samir Shah. He's under pressure for his handling of recent events after the resignations of both the Director General and Head of News earlier this month, and then on Friday, board member Shumit Banerjee, who stepped down blaming governance issues at the very top of the broadcaster. There are also likely to be questions about political appointments to the BBC board. BBC bosses will need to demonstrate to MPs they have a clear plan for the future of the corporation.
The former Prime Minister, David Cameron, has revealed he's been treated for prostate cancer. He told the Times newspaper that his wife had insisted he go for a checkup after they listened to an interview on this programme with the entrepreneur Nick Jones, who was campaigning for men to be tested after being diagnosed himself. Barry Caffrey reports.
David Cameron had a prostate-specific antigen test earlier this year, followed by an MRI scan and a biopsy. He was then treated with focal therapy, where electrical pulses target and destroy cancer cells. He told the Times newspaper that he wanted to use his platform to support a call by Prostate Cancer Research for screening to be offered to high-risk men. Lord Cameron says there are respectable arguments against a screening programme, but now was a good moment to have another look at the idea. Prostate cancer is the most common cancer in men in the UK, with around 55,000 new cases every year.
A three-year-old boy from California with a rare debilitating condition has become the first person in the world to be treated with a gene therapy developed in Manchester. Oliver Chu has Hunter syndrome, which causes progressive damage throughout the body. His parents say the treatment has given him as close to a normal life as possible. More details from our medical editor, Fergus Walsh.
Oliver Chu has astounded medical staff at Royal Manchester Children's Hospital with his rapid development in recent months. Before the treatment, the toddler was unable to produce an enzyme crucial for keeping cells healthy due to a faulty gene. In the most severe cases of Hunter syndrome, patients often don't survive beyond the age of 20. But in a world first, cells were removed from Oliver's blood and a working copy of the faulty gene designed in Manchester was inserted before the modified cells were given back to him. He's now producing the missing enzyme and has stopped all other treatment. four other boys will receive the gene therapy as part of a trial. Doctors remain cautious, but the hope is the one-off treatment could be a permanent fix for this rare condition.
The messaging app Snapchat has started asking users in Australia to verify their age in advance of a ban on under-16s using social media. It's one of 10 platforms facing hefty fines if they don't comply with the law, which comes into force on the 10th of December. Snapchat has warned that disconnecting children from their friends and family may push them to apps that are less safe and less private.
Thank you, Caroline. It's just coming round to 7:09. So what is the US position on the best way to end the war in Ukraine? Well, first, there was a leaked ceasefire proposal heavily weighted in favour of Russia's demands. The US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, said that talks between America, Ukraine and Europe, or between their negotiators at least, made tremendous progress yesterday. But in contrast to that, you have President Trump once again saying that Ukraine had showed, in his words, zero gratitude for the US's attempts to stop the fighting. Well, I spoke earlier to William B. Taylor, who's a former US ambassador to Ukraine and chargé d'affaires at the US Embassy in Kyiv during the first Trump administration. And I asked him what direction he thought the White House was taking.
So you're right. The leaked agreement, the draft that was leaked by the Russians, we should say, is definitely pro-Russian, as you would expect. And a lot of the commentary, a lot of the expectation based on that of that leaked document was that, oh, the Americans are flipped again. You know, they're going back to supporting the Russians over the Ukrainians. It's not clear yet. I think we really do need to see what the documents are and what improvements, what changes, what recommendations the Ukrainians have made, and indeed what the Europeans have made, to see what the current position of the United States government is. We do have some, you know, tweets or social media inserts from President Trump, but nonetheless, we have actions from him reflecting the U.S. government that put sanctions on the Russians first time, and we have strong support for serious measures to be put on the Russians from the Congress and from the American people. So the short answer to your question is, I believe we're still very strongly supporting the Ukrainians, but the document will help us understand that question better.
One of the great difficulties about the talks that are happening at the moment is that they involve the US, Ukraine, Europe. But again, Russia is not in the room. And whatever comes out of that, if it is not pleasing to Russia, then it'll be a non-starter. We've seen this happen more than once already.
And what we have to do in that case is to make it a starter. What we have to do in that case is put pressure on Putin to come off of his current position, which is just to wait us out. Just to wait out the Ukrainians, which he'll not do, wait out the Europeans. The Europeans are standing up and try to wait out the Americans. And if we hang tough, then we can force him come to the table. But up to now, we have not done that. We have started to do that. And if we have a united position between the Ukrainians and the Americans and the Europeans, and then put the pressure, military and economic, on Putin, we can get there.
Why do you think there was a point at which the US seemed to be supporting a proposal which did things like limit the size of the Ukrainian army or make security guarantees that weren't really underpinned with anything concrete?
On the first item there, I'm not sure we did support limits on the Ukrainian army. Again, that leaked document would indicate that we did. But that leaked document, in my view, has no credibility. What we have to see is what the real document is, what the document that that the Secretary of the Army, Driscoll, presented to President Zelensky. But I haven't seen what the current one, so I can't say that we support reducing the size. I don't support that. I'm in favor, as I think we've heard Secretary Rubio say and others, that we support a sovereign Ukraine. And a sovereign nation does not have outsiders, whether it's Russians or anybody else, telling them how many soldiers they need and how many soldiers they should have. So in that regard, I think it is too soon to say.
Do you feel like things are different this time? Because, of course, there's been momentum before and it's fallen away. Does it feel to you that now is the moment that this war might move at least to a ceasefire?
I think the right step is to move to a ceasefire. In the leaked document, again, without credibility, the ceasefire comes at the end. It's the last of the 20, it's number 28 of 28. It needs to be number one. The ceasefire does need to be there. And in answer to your question, I would say, yes, there is potential here for movement to end this war, which is really what President Trump has been talking about ever since the campaign. So more than a year, he's been talking about ending this war. He thought he could do it in 24 hours. He obviously couldn't. It's a complicated one, and it's an entrenched one. And the Putin problem is one that I think President Trump really didn't appreciate. He thought he could be friends with Putin. But that I think he has now understood that that's not the case. So now is the opportunity. Now is the possibility of ending this war again with pressure on Putin and unity among the Ukrainians, Americans and Europeans.
William B. Taylor, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Anna.
In around about an hour's time, we'll hear from our Moscow editor, Steve Rosenberg, and the former head of MI6, Sir Alex Younger, will join us as well. It is now 14 minutes past seven. Are we witnessing a generational shift as reading for pleasure dies out, denying young people the stimulation and the sanctuary, the wit and the wisdom that their parents benefited from? That fear lies behind a new inquiry by MPs on the Education Select Committee, and the committee's chair, Helen Hayes, joins us now. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Why are you so worried about this?
So we know that reading for pleasure has declined really rapidly over the last 20 years. We know that now just one in three children aged 8 to 18 read in their spare time. And it's a decline that continues. And we've seen an even further steep decline in just over the last year. So as a committee, we want to understand what are the different forces at play driving that decline? Why is it happening? We want to look at what can be done to reverse it. We're interested in any examples of good practice across the country. And we want to understand how what we know are great benefits from reading for pleasure can be drawn down for this generation of children and for the next.
Presumably you, like everybody else, knows the headline answer, which is the appeal of screens. The much harder policy question is what you then do about that.
So screens, we anticipate, will be part of what our evidence tells us. But I don't think we can take a defeatist approach to that. We know that reading for pleasure is a way that children's imaginations are stimulated. It's a way that their horizons are expanded and that there are really significant benefits for their mental health and well-being as well. So these are benefits that are worth having. And that's what we want to explore through our inquiry.
In about half an hour on the programme, we're going to be hearing from Australia, where this ban on social media use for young people under 16 is coming in. Snapchat is the latest to take people off that platform. Is that the sort of idea you want to examine? Is it one that you're tempted by?
So I think that there is strong evidence for a ban on smartphones in schools, for example, and many head teachers are calling for the government to implement a ban. But we're looking much more widely at that. We want to understand what's happening in the home environment when babies and very young children can be reading with their parents to great benefit. We want to understand what's happening in early years settings and in schools. What is the role of community libraries, some of which have closed across the country in recent years? What are all of the different factors that are contributing to this?
I understand there's a broader range of questions, but are you going to examine specifically the idea of banning young people from having, from owning, from using either the mobile phone itself, a smartphone at least, and indeed social media apps?
So the predecessor committee to my committee undertook some work in this area, and my committee is continuing to follow up on the evidence in that space. This isn't specifically part of our terms of reference for this inquiry, but we do anticipate that we'll receive a lot of evidence about the impact of phones, and we'll be looking at that really carefully and making our recommendations.
Now, we've only just seen, I think I'm right in saying, a review of the national curriculum. It's a shame in a way that your work won't be able to feed into that, isn't it?
Well, we've had the final report of the independent Becky Francis independent curriculum and assessment review, but there's still quite a long way to go to implement that. So we think our inquiry will still be timely as the government seeks to implement some of Becky Francis's recommendations and as the detail of that review really starts to filter down into schools.
Helen Hayes, Chair of the Education Select Committee, thanks for joining us.
It is 18 minutes past seven. Business is holding its breath again. That's what the head of the Confederation of British Industry will warn the Chancellor today ahead of Wednesday's budget. Will's back with more.
Morning again, Anna. Yes, the CBI Director General is set to use her speech at their annual conference in London today to warn businesses feel they're stuck in Groundhog Day and that more rumours and U-turns risk creating a stop-start economy. Rain Newton-Smith joins us now. Rain, morning.
Good morning.
And clearly here you seem to be concerned about the U-turn on the rise in income tax rises and what perhaps comes in its place. I'm looking at another quote from your speech here. That means making hard choices for growth now before they get harder. Having the courage to take two tough decisions rather than 20 easy ones. It means one or two broad tax rises rather than death by a thousand cuts. Are you telling the Chancellor then today to pivot back to that income tax rise?
I think what we're saying today is the business leaders that I speak to say we can't face a groundhog budget on Wednesday. If we think back to last year, businesses were asked to shoulder a huge burden in terms of the overall increase in taxation with £24 billion of costs per year through the increase in national insurance contributions. And we're seeing the impact of that play out in our economy with rising unemployment and slowing growth. So as the Chancellor faces some of those decisions on Wednesday, we can't see a rise of that on business. And it's absolutely critical as well that we don't see a whole range of tax rises that ends up adding to the distortions in our economy. And it's important to make some brave decisions.
That would mean pivoting back to income tax, wouldn't it? Because it's pretty much the only one of the other big taxes, income tax or national insurance, because otherwise it is going to be a series of smaller taxes.
Well, look, the speculation seems to be that we now won't be going down that road. But there's no doubt that a rise in income tax is a broader based tax. It would spread the load and therefore have less of a damaging impact on our economy. But I think the other thing that I'm hearing from business leaders is the other way of squaring the circle is not just through tax rises. We need to make sure our public services are delivered efficiently. We need to make sure that we pick up the pace of delivery on the growth mission. We need to get Britain building.
Yeah,
the Chancellor
has
been brave.
It seems to me like you've really lost patience with that. As you go through this, through your speech as well, this budget's about credibility, about trust. You talk as well about plans not pouring the concrete. Do you feel there's been a lot of words and not enough action?
Yes, I think we've seen a lot of words, but we're not seeing enough action on the ground. And I know the Chancellor shares some of that frustration. In the budget last year, she set aside £120 billion in capital spending to be spent over this Parliament. But at the moment, we're not seeing that capital spending on the ground, building more homes, building reservoirs, building the transport connections that our country and our businesses and our communities desperately need. So we need to pick up the pace. And one of the things we're calling for is more planners to get some of those decisions made more quickly. And the Chancellor will announce some of that today, which we've been calling for. But more broadly, we need to just pick up the pace of delivery. Yeah. I think there is a palpable sense of frustration. Yeah. I think in other areas, the government have said they're going to address the incredibly high energy costs that our businesses face. But some of those measures won't really come into play for another couple of years. I think many businesses in chemicals, in our farming industry, can't wait that long.
Action rather than words, as you say. Just one final quick one. Interesting list on your speakers. A change on your list today. At 4 o'clock, you're going to hear from Zia Yusuf, the head of policy of Reform UK. Don't think they've addressed the conference before. Why did you think it was worth members hearing from Reform?
Well, we think it's really important that businesses hear from politicians from across the political spectrum. We're really excited.
But I can't see a Liberal Democrat.
We do have.
We're
really excited to be inviting Daisy Cooper, the deputy leader of the Liberal Democrats. It's so important that we have politicians from across the political spectrum. And I think with Reform, they've made announcements on economic policies. I think businesses want to know, can they fund those? And when we look at some of the announcements they've made on ripping up contracts for difference, what does that mean for the overall investment landscape in the UK? I think it's really important that we hold all our politicians to account on the policies and promises that they make.
Rain Newton-Smith, thanks so much for your time this morning.
It is 7:22 now, and it's that time of year again. Snow, mistletoe, holly, Christmas carols, and yes, no run-up to Christmas would be complete without it. The unveiling of the Today programme's Christmas guest editor list.
The first is the actor, the humanitarian, Kate Blanchett, known for her roles in so many award-winning films. She's been Elizabeth I, she's been in Bob Dylan, in Lord of the Rings, and now has a new role as Today guest editor. And she'll be using her programme to explore a range of ideas, including the impact of evolving AI tech on women in the film industry. She'll be talking about sustainability in the world of fashion, how nation states are responding to the refugee crisis, and why gardening is good for the soul. That is just for starters. Let's hear from the others.
Hi, my name is Tom Holland. I'm a historian and presenter of the podcast The Rest is History, and I am absolutely thrilled to be guest editing the Today programme, which I've been listening to since I was a child. I think it's basically perfect, but there are a few areas where it could be improved upon. I don't think that there have been enough items about dinosaurs, so I'm going to be improving on that. And I don't think there's ever been an item about Japanese toilet ghosts, so that is another gap that I will be filling. And I've got all kinds of treats for you, including the looming 1100th anniversary of the birth of England, so England's birthday.
Only the King of Kings, only what once was mine.
Hi, I'm Mustafa Suleiman. I'm the CEO of Microsoft AI, and I'm very excited to say that I'm going to be guest editing the Today program on Radio 4, and I'm going to be asking some of the big questions of our time. How do we manage the transition to a post-AI world, and what it might mean for all of us? What will happen to our governments? What does AI mean for some of the core questions of human existence, our consciousness, our creativity? And how do we fundamentally ensure that this technology works for all of us?
Only at Christmas time, he brings us peace, he brings us joy, he brings all thoughts.
I've always enjoyed the guest edits because they cover such a wide variety of subjects. I'm Theresa May, the former UK Prime Minister, and I'm delighted to be guest editing the Today programme this year. I'm going to be exploring some of the issues that I've worked with over the years, modern slavery and domestic abuse and trust in politics. I'll be taking some of my work from fact to fiction, interviewing one of my favourite authors. And there might even be some cricket. You'll be able to hear me on the Today programme on Radio 4 between Christmas and New Year. And unlike when I was in government, this time I'm looking forward to it.
Hello, I'm Melvin Bragg. I'm one of this year's guest editors for the coming festive season. We'll be talking about the idea of the Nativity. How much fact have we got about that compared with faith? Where did the three kings come from? We'll be talking about what this place will be like, Earth, that is to say, in 100 years' time.
I'm James Dyson, inventor and entrepreneur, and I'm very pleased to have been invited to be a guest editor on the Today programme between Christmas and the New Year. I like doers in life, people who are dissatisfied with the status quo, and you want to experiment and improve things and make a difference. So I'm going to introduce you to some people who've done this in education, in dementia research, in farming, and in family businesses. So I very much hope you'll join me and listen in on Radio 4 Today programme between Christmas and the New Year. I hope you'll enjoy some of the people I'm going to introduce you to.
So, back to today.
How lovely to hear Melvin saying that. We're going to miss him when he's no longer able to say that. But he's back for the guest editors, along with Tom Holland, Mustafa Suleiman, Theresa May, Sir James Dyson and Kate Blanchett. You can hear all those special editions of Today between Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve on BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sound. So when you're thinking,
I don't want the news over Christmas. You get the news that you really need, sports news and all that as well, of course, but you will get some fabulous extra features, insights and thoughts of our very distinguished guest editors.
Yeah, it's a very good, a very eclectic collection of voices. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We will as well. Now, Mike is back with sport.
I'm looking forward to hearing Theresa May's reflections on the ongoing Ashes series, of course. Quite. She's a huge cricket fan.
Yeah, I don't imagine she's in favour of batting. No. Kind of steady at the wicket type, don't
Absolutely, they? Yes. Well, we will reflect on it ourselves in just a moment. But first, Arsenal, 6 points clear at the top of the Premier League this morning after a convincing victory over rivals Tottenham yesterday in the North London derby. Eberechi Eze with a hat-trick as Arsenal won 4-1. There was a first defeat of the season for Scottish Premiership leaders Hearts, though. They were beaten 1-0 by Aberdeen. But we unfortunately now do have to talk cricket because I'm afraid we just can't avoid it any longer.
Well, Australia has stormed to a 1-0 Ashes series lead after one of the all-time great turnarounds in Perth.
That will be a devastating blow for England. Within 2 days, they've lost the match.
5-0 incoming! Woo! Come here, these!
Up the Aussies!
The best to do it. We beat them. We're 1-0 up, boys!
We'll let this hurt, because it does. We've got to get over this and get back training hard, as we always do, and then get ourselves to Brisbane and come away with the result we want there.
Too easy, England!
Same old Aussies, always winning.
Yeah, I think we've all heard quite enough there of gloating Aussies for 7:29 on a Monday morning, but the post-mortem on England's embarrassing two-day defeat to Australia in the first Ashes test continues. Australia blew them away in their second innings on Saturday morning, wrapping up an 8-wicket victory in Perth to put them 1-0 up in the series. So let's pick over the bones of that defeat with the former England assistant coach Paul Farbrace, who joins us on the programme. Morning, Paul.
Good morning. Lovely to hear those Aussies being so graceful in defeat. Graceful in victory.
Well, exactly.
Absolutely fantastic. Lovely.
Yeah. What did you make of it all on Saturday?
Well, look, I mean, like everybody else, I think at lunchtime on day two, we're thinking bat one session and we're in such a great position to win this test match. I mean, there were two things that happened. Travis Head played one of the greatest test match innings in an Ashes series you will ever see. But our batting from lunch to tea time was so disappointing. You know, I've heard words like arrogant. I think I might have used arrogant myself on Saturday during the afternoon. But it was so frustrating. We just didn't learn from the way that we batted and the way that they bowled in the first innings to understand how our batters needed to play that afternoon session. We literally had to bat one session and maybe most of the evening session and put ourselves in a position where the Australians couldn't get anywhere near us.
Zach Crawley coming in for a lot of critique, a lot of emphasis on him after his performance, certainly out in a duck in the first innings. People are already calling for Jacob Bethell to replace the opener. Would you go along with that?
No, definitely not. This England team will stick with the same 11. The only possibility is they might play one less seamer at Brisbane and maybe bring an extra batter into the middle order to boost them. That may allow Bethell or Jax to play in the middle order and reduce the seamers by one. But I would be amazed if England changed their team. You know, the pitch at Brisbane will be the same at Perth. It's a hard, bouncy, quick wicket. And it was the bounce that got people out. It wasn't the sideways movement. It wasn't the swing. It was the bounce. And I think England will stick to the same team. I mean, that they're very belligerent in the way that they think about things. They think that they're doing the right thing. Their preparation, they're happy with. They're very happy with the way that they play and they approach the game. They're not going to bow down to media pressure and former greats of the game. I won't call them has-beens and their views. They will stick to what they think. And I admire them for that. I really do. But I don't think they'll change the team.
Well, they've certainly got a while to stew on that first test defeat. The second test is not until next Thursday in Brisbane at the Gabba, where Whisperer England do not have a particularly good record either in Brisbane. We shall see how they fare there, and I'm sure speak to you again as this series continues. Paul Farbrace, former England assistant coach, many thanks for joining us on the programme this morning. As we say, that second test, next Thursday. And just to say, in the next hour of this programme, talking Formula One after a dramatic weekend at the Las Vegas Grand Prix, Damon Hill will join us on the next hour.
Excellent, Mike. Thank you very much indeed. Later today, we'll encounter some sparring siblings.
Two feuding sisters.
What's wrong, Florence? You look like you, only worse.
Just stop.
Stop it!
Played by Dawn French.
I'm famous for my versatility.
And Jennifer Saunders.
I have been painted more times than the Clifton Suspension Bridge.
David Quantick's comedy of sisterly sniping.
Selena, don't read over my shoulder. You're not a parrot. Darling, I read several of your depressing stories about lonely women who live in cheap hotels. How dare you?
Whatever Happened to Baby Jane Austen starts this afternoon at 2:15 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
The weather today, we'll see variable clouds, sunny intervals, showers moving in from the north at times. I would keep your expectations low, though. Helen Willett said it was already pouring outside in certain places, so just don't expect much. It's autumn.
Yeah, take your brolly. Now, coming up, you may remember that almost a year ago, Nick Jones spoke to this programme about his own personal experience of prostate cancer.
I feel I'm very lucky, and at my luck, what I want to do with it is talk a lot about prostate cancer, not make it feel embarrassing, make it feel like a everyday conversation. And I also want everyone, not just me who could go to a private doctor, but everyone who can't afford to go to a private doctor should have exactly the same screening as I have.
And let's come to that. But just, you know, for you now, having gone through this, you've obviously very passionate about trying to get this to change.
I'm very passionate. And I do look at the brilliant women back in the 80s who fought hard, campaigned hard to get mammograms. And from that, every woman now gets a letter at the age of 50 for a mammogram. And it saved tens of thousands of lives. All I'm asking for, and so many people are asking for, is that men get the same right for a screening at the age of 45, if you're a black man, and 50 for everyone else.
Well, one person listening to Nick Jones when he made that plea was Samantha Cameron, the wife of the former Prime Minister David Cameron, who urged him to go and see his doctor after she heard that interview. And now, after receiving a cancer diagnosis, he's announced his support for Nick's campaign. I mean, the good news is that David Cameron's treatment seems to have been effective. He is supporting the campaign to spread that cancer screening. And we'll hear more from Nick Jones just before 8 o'clock.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster. It's 26 minutes to 8, time for Summer of the News with Caroline Nichols.
The United States and Ukraine say they've drafted an updated and refined framework to end the war with Russia, following their first day of talks in Geneva. A joint statement issued by the White House said any eventual deal must fully uphold Ukraine's sovereignty and deliver a just and sustainable peace. The employers group, the CBI, will call on ministers to spare business from further tax rises in the budget as its annual conference gets underway. Its Director General, Rayne Newton-Smith, told us businesses were telling her they couldn't face a groundhog budget, with companies asked again to shoulder a big burden of taxation as they did last year. A task force commissioned by the Prime Minister is calling for radical changes to the way the nuclear industry is regulated. Its report says the UK has an overly complex system which delays new power plants being built. Environmental groups say it would be madness to rip up tried and tested nuclear safety rules. Some of the key figures in the row about editorial standards at the BBC are expected to face tough questions from MPs today. They include the corporation's chairman and two board members. They're likely to be asked for their views on the state of the BBC and its journalism and give their accounts of events behind the scenes. Lord Cameron has revealed he's been successfully treated for prostate cancer. The former Prime Minister told the Times newspaper he wanted to use his platform to call for more men to be screened for the disease, especially those at high risk. A three-year-old boy from California who has a rare genetic disorder called Hunter syndrome has been successfully treated with a gene therapy developed in Manchester over the course of 15 years. Oliver Chu is now able to produce an enzyme crucial for keeping cells healthy. His parents say his speech, mobility, agility and cognitive functions have all improved significantly.
Caroline, thank you very much indeed. It's 24 minutes to 8. It's going to be another difficult day for the folk who lead the BBC. The chairman of the corporation, Samir Shah, will face cross-examination this afternoon by MPs on the Commons Culture Select Committee about the events which led up to the resignation of both the BBC's head of news and the director general. The hearings will start with evidence from the man who wrote the memo, which was leaked, which triggered the crisis. Michael Prescott said in that memo he felt despair at the lack of action from BBC management when editorial failures in the current
coverage of Donald Trump, trans rights and Gaza, to name just three, when those editorial failings had come to light. We'll talk in a moment to the former chief creative officer of BBC Productions. Let's talk first to our culture and media editor who's following this story for us, Katie Razzle. Morning to you, Katie. You wrote over the weekend, and many newspapers followed it up, that Samir Shah might find himself fighting for his job. Why so?
Well, I think the pressure is on him right now, isn't it, Nick? We reported on Friday the resignation of one of the members of the board, Shamit Banerjee, who made two complaints in his resignation letter, which we haven't been shown, but which I understand talked about governance issues, which felt like a direct attack on the chairman, Samir Shah. And also he said he hadn't been consulted in the events that led to the resignations of the director general and the CEO of News. So today, Samir Shah does need to come out and really impress people and get on the front foot, I suppose, when it comes to what happened at the BBC. I mean, you'll know, you've watched these committees over the years. I would say this committee, what happens this afternoon, it does have the potential to be box office, at least for those who are interested in these matters, but they also do have a tendency to be a letdown. So let's see. It's happening this afternoon. But clearly, if you're interested in these stories, as we all are, and wider, you know, of course people are, because so much has been claimed and so much of it is very important, you know, there are some key questions that they need to answer. You know, as you say, Michael Prescott says his claims were ignored. Was he right to say that? And then that bigger issue, has the BBC been, is the BBC systemically biased? And in some coverage, at least, as Michael Prescott says, and I understand that is something that Samir Shah will address head on today.
Now, he's not the only one in the firing line, the chairman of the BBC, is he? He's not the only one in the firing line, because as well as the memo author, a board member, normally board members are fairly anonymous outside broadcasting circles, has become very well known, talked about a lot in the media. Sir Robbie Gibb used to work here at the BBC in charge of political programmes, but went on to be former director of communications for Theresa May, and has been accused by some of politicising the board and pursuing his own agenda.
Yes, that's exactly right. And the optics of it will be very interesting, because we've got three people giving evidence from the BBC at the same time, sitting in a row. Samir Shah, the chairman, Sir Robbie Gibb, as you say, and also Caroline Thompson, who is another board member who was once a BBC executive. So it'll be interesting to see. I understand certainly some of them have been rehearsing for this over the last few days inside the BBC. The question is, you know, are they all on message, if you like? Will they all be saying the same thing? Because the suggestions have been that Robbie Gibb is he's a political appointment, just as Samir Shah is. But the claims have been that perhaps he has particular views about bias, about liberal bias at the BBC that he has been pushing, and that he has managed to persuade others on the board to agree with him. And so that is clearly the key question, is what will they be saying? Will Samir Shah be saying one thing and Sir Robbie Gibb something else? Or have they, you know, are we wrong about that? And actually, are they very much all on the same page? We will find out.
We will indeed find out after 3:30. But let's talk before then to Pat Young, who is chair of the British Broadcasting Challenge, an organisation whose recommendations are contained in a report called Renewing the BBC. He used to be chief creative officer of BBC Productions. Morning to you, Pat. Before we talk about the specifics of who said what to whom, what happened, I'm struck by a piece you've written in The Guardian where you say we have not been here before. A reply to those people who say, who've got long memories, look, there was a crisis under Tony Blair in the BBC, there's a crisis under Margaret Thatcher, you can go back to Eden and Wilson, and even Churchill all had rows with the BBC. Why do you say it's different this time?
Because what makes this moment different is that the total news and information landscape has changed. The world's six richest men, that's Musk, Ellison, Zuckerberg, Bezos, Page and Brin, own between them X or Twitter, Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram, Amazon Prime Video, Amazon Web Services, CBS, YouTube, Google. These six men own or control most of the means we all use to discover, share, consume content. The BBC stands separate to that. It now stands alone as a mass, publicly owned broadcaster with the scale, at least, to protect our national interest in an otherwise privatized world of news and information.
But of course, there'll be people listening. There'll be people listening who may say, well, look, hold on. If the BBC can't be trusted to get it right in the way it presents news, whether it's on Trump or on trans rights or on Gaza or on history programmes, there was a great long list in that Prescott memo, people will not be willing to pay what is in effect a compulsory tax, the licence fee, in order to get that news.
Absolutely. And the reason that we can have a conversation about the BBC is that it's publicly owned. I mean, I don't know if you saw the revelations this week that most of the MAGA movement on Twitter or X is actually based in Russia, Eastern Europe, Nigeria and Australia, shows you that these other platforms are algorithmically driven to sort of promote conflict and dissent, because that's what drives their economic model. The BBC is founded on very different principles. And yes, we always want the BBC to be better. And it is very hard to be a space, a forum for divergent views in a very polarised world.
So a quick one on the thing that the committee has to address today, which, to put it crudely, it is a lot more complicated than this, but there is a crude question at the heart of this. Is Samir Shah the right man to lead that challenge? And is Sir Robbie Gibb the right person to have on the board fighting for better editorial standards?
Shah is the right man to lead the challenge right now, partly because we've just lost the Director General and the Head of News and we're going into a charter renewal. As for Gibb, I think people are asking the wrong question. I mean, why is the Robbie Gibb problem so hard to deal with? Well, unlike other independent members of the board can't remove Robbie Gibb. Robbie Gibb was appointed by the King in Council, and only the King in Council can remove him. So the problem is this political appointment directly onto the board, which is what we have at the BBC. Yeah. We need to have independently appointed people on the board of the BBC, and we need to hold them to account.
Pat Young, thank you very much indeed. I'm sure Robbie Gibb will point out later, but it is worth knowing factually, there have always been political appointments to the BBC, and Sir Robbie Gibb is not the only political appointment to the BBC, but he has perhaps become the most controversial.
It is 16 minutes to 8 now. On December the 10th, so only a couple of weeks away, teenagers in Australia, well, under 16s at least, will be banned from using social media platforms, things like Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat. They're hoping it's a radical way to protect children, and big tech companies that don't comply will be fined if they don't do it. Well, on Thursday's programme, we heard from Greg Atwells, who's director of the 36 Months campaign that encouraged the law change. And this was as Meta began to send out notices to younger users that it would start to shut down their accounts.
Parents are up against million, trillion-dollar attention engines in big tech, and it's very difficult to outparent an algorithm that's been weaponized to exploit vulnerability. I am proud of our government for leading the way on this. You know, when it comes to money, societal power, lobbying reach, nothing comes close to big tech. And when a government chooses to side with families instead of playing into their hand, that's leadership, and I think we should back it.
Not everyone agrees, though. John Ruddick is a member of the New South Wales Parliament from the Libertarian Party, and he is planning to legally challenge that world-first social media ban for teenagers. So I asked him why he is opposing a ban that thousands of Australian parents support.
Well, I have two objections to the Commonwealth Government's ban on social media for under 16s. The first is that this has been sold to us as something to protect kids. Now, we all know that bad things can happen on the internet, but what's going to happen here now is that parents are going to assume, oh, well, my kids aren't on social media if they're under 16 because the Prime Minister has looked after it for me. The kids are very, very tech savvy. We all know that. The word is going around every playground in Australia about how to get around this ban. Now, the government has banned 9 social media sites, all the biggest 9. Kids are going to work out how to get around it. So they're still going to be accessing social media, but it's going to be an underground social media. They've started off their life breaking the law. So that's our first objection. Now, the second objection is that we believe that these things, as George Orwell taught us many years ago, these things are just the beginning. We fear that this is going to be the beginning of further steps of the government controlling what information we get via the internet.
Okay, well, let's take those 2 points in order. First of all, you were saying that the kids will get around this. And you know what? I'm sure they will, because they get around most of the things somehow that they're not supposed to do. Is that a reason to not at least put a layer of protection in, though? Because it is something that parents are widely in favour of.
Well, they are when they don't, when they haven't thought about it. They are at face value. Now the online protection for kids is a paramount duty for today's parents. And those parents have to be taking full responsibility for it. They do not want, it is very foolish to think that they're going to delegate it to the government. This should be something that is front in mind for all parents.
But we have things like laws on the age at which you can buy alcohol or cigarettes, for example, and that is at least seen as a useful measure. So why would it not be in this case?
Well, I mean, look, if we're going to say that a kid has absolutely zero engagement with social media until they reach their 16th birthday, that means they're going to be just thrown into the deep end. Now, if kids have, so under parental supervision, if the kids have sort of for 5 or 6 years before that, learn how to spot something that is fishy on the internet, that will be far better for the kids than just being thrown into it and being absolutely oblivious to the threats that are there. So, no, we do not want the state to be acting as parents. Yeah, well, I think what's going to happen is a lot of parents will just simply not believe it's an issue anymore because the TV is going to have told them, oh, the Prime Minister is going to save your kids from internet baddies. Okay, well, that is a recipe for disaster. And kids will be in the underground internet. And that's where there will be much worse things because there'll be no parental supervision. And it won't be on like straightforward platforms that we know about. People will be getting around it. And then it'll be an absolute wild west. So no, parents should be, they should be somewhat paranoid about what their kids see on social media. That is the attitude that they have because, look, on balance, social media is a very, very good thing. When I was 9 years old, my mother bought me the Encyclopedia Britannica. And I used to just sit there for hours and hours and hours reading it, okay, because I was interested in history and politics and things like this. Now, kids, when they get to about the age of 9 or 10, they do start to develop an interest in certain subjects. And YouTube's been banned. The Australian government's going to ban YouTube for under 16s. YouTube is extremely educational for whatever field young kids are interested in. So I could imagine myself when I was 9, 10, 11, 12, I would have loved YouTube. I would have loved reading about history.
Yeah, it's so much broader though, isn't it? You know that you can sit a child down with the encyclopedia and they're not going to happen across something that you wouldn't want them to read.
No, but my point is that there are very inquisitive kids out there and the best way for them to get information, or a very, very big way of getting information, a massive store of information, is, of course, the internet, social media, YouTube and other places.
John Ruddock, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Anna.
It is 11 minutes to 8 now. It's time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Jasveer Singh, co-chair of the City Sikhs charity and vice chair of the Faiths Forum for London.
Good morning. Over the weekend, I went to the cinema with some old school friends to see the eagerly anticipated film Wicked for Good. My husband and I have been fans of the stage musical for years, and I'm relieved to say that the film lived up to my expectations. Without giving any spoilers, one line really stood out to me from it. We can't let good be just a word. It has to mean something. This seems particularly pertinent to me this week, as Sikhs mark 350 years since the martyrdom of the ninth Sikh guru. Guru Tegh Bahadur gave his life not to save his own faith, but to defend the rights of another religion. The guru was known for his humility, and in 1675 he was approached by a group of Hindu pundits from Kashmir, who were under attack because of their beliefs. They were in danger of being forcibly converted to another faith on pain of death, and they feared that if they converted, the majority of their Hindu followers across India would feel they had no choice but to do the same. The Mughal emperor had told them that if they could find someone more holy than them to sacrifice his own life instead, they would not have to convert. The Guru thought carefully about what he could do, and he eventually realised that the only way to help was to offer himself in place of the pundits. He and some close disciples made their way to the imperial capital. They were arrested, tortured, and publicly executed on the busiest street of Delhi as a warning to others. It was a watershed moment in Indian history, and over the course of this week, there will be celebrations of the Guru's life and ultimate sacrifice across India, including at the iconic Red Fort in Delhi, the place where the order for the Guru's execution was given by the Mughal emperor. Amongst his many verses within the Sikh scriptures, Guru Tegh Bahadur said, "One who does not cause terror to anyone and who is not afraid of anyone else, saith Nanak, listen, O mind, call him spiritually wise." It's easy to just look out for oneself in this chaotic world. After all, human self-interest is a powerful force, And we do live in a highly divisive society where even the simplest conversation can quickly become deeply heated. But if we take a moment to stop and reflect before we act, and if we respect the genuinely held views of others without ever compromising our own beliefs, I think those walls of division would crumble far more easily than we might think. The word good can mean something.
That was Thought for the Day with Jasveer Singh, co-chair of the City Sikhs charity and vice-chair of the Faiths Forum for London. It is 8 minutes to eight now. The former Prime Minister David Cameron has revealed that he's been treated for prostate cancer, and he's calling for a national screening programme, echoing the calls from the likes of Sir Chris Hoy, who also has the disease. There is a major announcement about whether that might happen, which is due this week. And he told The Times that his wife Samantha urged him to get tested after hearing Nick Jones, the founder of Soho House, talking about his own experience of prostate cancer on the radio, which he's done many times on this programme and is here again this morning. Nick, hello.
Good morning.
Whenever you come here, and I know that talking about something which is very private and very emotional, it can be, and when you dig deep, the point is for somebody somewhere to benefit from it.
Indeed. And that was the reason why I spoke about it, because I felt I was very lucky and I felt everyone should get that luck. And I think that everyone should be able to get screened, and if they do have prostate cancer, have every chance of surviving it.
And when you hear that your words, just sitting here having a conversation on the radio like we have before, that they affect somebody, regardless of who it is, whether it's a teacher or a bin man or a former prime minister, I mean, what is that feeling like?
Well, I play a very small part of this and I obviously feel delighted, but it shouldn't be me coming into radio studios talking about it. There should be a national screening programme where everyone benefits.
I know that you feel really strongly about this and you've talked about it before. And as I touched on there, it is a crucial week this week.
An absolute crucial week. The National Screening Committee are meeting to decide whether screening should be brought in for all men for prostate cancer.
I hadn't realised, and you were telling me this, that this, it is the only cancer that doesn't have its own screening programme.
It's the only major cancer which doesn't have a screening programme, which seems, in this day and age, totally ridiculous.
And just remind us the reasoning that's been given before for why that isn't the case.
Well, the reasoning is over-treatment and cost. And those were a case 5 years ago, but now the data has changed, the treatments have changed and the outcomes have changed. And it is a time now for the screening committee to look at all those changes and make the right decision.
And the right decision is for you just bringing one in.
Bringing screening in. Initially, a screening programme for black men and men with history, and then further on, a screening programme for everyone.
I remember when Sir Chris Hoy first talked about this, and I think people were surprised that even if there is a family history at the moment, it's still something that you have to go searching for. It doesn't happen.
You have to go searching for it. You have to go to your doctor, your GP, who often says that you don't need a PSA. And who wants to go and knock on the door of a doctor? It should be a letter in the post. It should be more information out there. Thousands of men are dying unnecessarily every year of prostate cancer, and there is a solution. And we and lots of people are asking the screening committee to make that change.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, sometimes you do need a nudge in that direction. You know, you might not quite understand what the issue is with prostate cancer. You might think, I've got a busy life, I don't want to bother anybody. You know, there are lots of things that come into play when you're trying to decide whether or not you need to push yourself forward for this.
Lots of things, but I would recommend any man, if you're a black man at 45, if you're a white man at 50, to knock on the door of your doctor and ask for a PSA. But I really do think that should be the job of the National Health Service and a screening programme in place to encourage people to come forward, because it is costing the country a lot of money, people at stage 3, stage 4 of prostate cancer. It's taking away men at a very important part of their lives, and this can be stopped.
What would you say to men who may be listening, you know, they're listening to you again and they think, well, I don't want to be a burden, I don't want to bother anybody, I'm not sure if this is an issue for me. You know, speaking directly to them now, what would you say?
Well, I wouldn't be just talking to men, I'd be talking to children, I'd be talking to wives, I'd be talking to partners of men, that, look, this is, if it's caught early, if prostate cancer is caught early, there is a 100% chance of survival. And if it's caught late, the situation is very different. So I would ask or beg any man to go and get screened.
Nick Jones, these are important conversations. And I'm glad that you've had one with us again. And thank you so much. And as we were saying, important week this week. And of course, that's a story that we will continue to follow on the programme as well, the outcome of that.
We certainly will. It's been fascinating. And the good news is that David Cameron, you know, has talked about it in part because he has had successful treatment for his prostate cancer.
BBC Scam Safe Week on Radio 4.
Helping you stay informed in the fight against scams.
Take a closer look at how scams work and how you can protect yourself in Scam Secrets.
There's comedy with me, Leila Navabi, in This Is Your Bank.
And in the food programme, we'll follow an unbelievable case of fraud in the tea industry.
BBC Scam Safe Week.
Across this week on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Time for the weather now. Here's Helen.
Nick, thanks very much. Hello there. Good morning. Low pressure's with us, so the day will be unsettled. In fact, the week will be. Starting cold, not as cold as last week, but becoming mild really by midweek. So different feel for many, but today we've still got that wind mainly coming down from the north, and it's a brisk wind as that as well. So for England and Wales, there are lots of showery bands of rain at the moment circulating that area of low pressure, driven on by a strong and gusty wind, particularly around southern and western coasts. Now, as we go through the day, a lot of that showery rain will ease away, and we'll be left still with some showers this afternoon, but probably a little bit more drier weather, brighter weather, a little bit of sunshine, the premium of which will be in western areas, I feel, but still that brisk wind. So temperatures about 6 to 10 degrees Celsius. For Northern Ireland, where we're sat further west of that low pressure, so there'll be fewer showers today and a bit more sunshine. I can't say it'll be completely dry because there will be a few showers around and about, and there's quite a chilly north wind, so 8 to 10 degrees are high here, but the compensation, more sunshine. For Scotland, also a very showery picture, particularly in eastern areas, as we're seeing really in the northeast of England, and there'll be snow over the hills and mountains as well. The best of the drier, brighter weather will be across western Scotland, around about 10 degrees here, but generally 4 to 7 for most. Now, through this evening and overnight, a ridge of high pressure moves in, so that dries the weather out, eases the showers, but it will be colder tonight and it'll be a colder start tomorrow, but it does look tomorrow like the driest day of the week.
Thank you, Helen. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson. Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 24th of November. The headlines this morning: Ukraine and the United States say they've agreed an updated and refined framework for a peace deal with Russia. We'll hear from our man in Moscow and we'll speak to the former head of MI6, Sir Alex Younger, after the news. The UK's biggest business group is urging the government to spare companies from more tax rises in the budget and to change course on workers' rights legislation. The business secretary will join us live.
And also coming up in the next hour, a gene therapy that was developed in Manchester has been credited with transforming the health of a three-year-old boy with a rare life-limiting condition. We'll hear from his dad and the doctor behind the treatment after the news. And filmmakers have captured, for the first time, the birth of a black rhino in the wild. We'll speak to the man who was there. And...
what is civilization? I don't know. I can't define it in abstract terms yet. But I think I can recognise it when I see it.
The masterful Kenneth Clarke, where his iconic documentary series Civilization is back, reimagined for 2025, and we will hear from the creator before 9 o'clock. Before all of that, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Caroline Nichols.
The White House says talks with Ukraine have made meaningful progress and an updated framework for a peace deal with Russia is now being considered. In a joint statement, American and Ukrainian officials said they'd identified clear next steps. The US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, said negotiations could continue into next week. Our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, reports from Geneva, where the discussions are being held.
Marco Rubio came out of hours of talks here to announce tremendous progress, as he put it, and insist there were just a couple of issues that would be resolved. But he wouldn't go into any details. And other reports suggest European officials have helped Kiev push back against some key points of his proposed peace deal. Ukraine is engaging with this process because it can't afford to lose US support and because Kiev really does want peace. But there is one demand on which it can't compromise. Ukraine needs the US to give the most robust possible security guarantees so that once this war is over, Russia never dares invade again. And it doesn't have that yet. The US Secretary of State said he would love an agreement to be reached by Thursday, as Donald Trump initially demanded, but he said the new deadline was as soon as possible.
The employers group, the Confederation of British Industry, is calling on the government to prioritise growth and spare business from further tax rises in the budget on Wednesday. Ministers and the Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch will speak at the organisation's conference in London, as our business editor Simon Jack reports.
Businesses are still licking their wounds from the last budget, which saw them bear the brunt of £40 billion in tax rises. While the CBI's Director General will acknowledge some positives, including new trade deals and a clearer industrial strategy, Rae Newton-Smith will urge Rachel Reeves to refrain from further tax hikes and to bear down on obstacles to growth, including regulation, planning and the high cost of energy. The Business Secretary, Peter Kyle, will promise the audience energy cost cuts for 7,000 firms. But the government shows no sign of backing down on a new employment rights bill that confers rights and protections around sick pay and unfair dismissal from day one of employment, despite many firms insisting it's discouraging hiring, a point the opposition leader Kemi Badenoch will make to the same audience.
Rae Newton-Smith explained on this programme why it was vital for economic growth that the Chancellor doesn't increase the tax burden on businesses.
Last year, businesses were asked to shoulder a huge burden in terms of the overall increase in taxation, with £24 billion of costs per year through the increase in national insurance contributions. And we're seeing the impact of that play out in our economy with rising unemployment and slowing growth. So we can't see a rise of that on business.
A panel of experts has called for radical changes to the way the nuclear industry is regulated to help speed up the construction of new power stations. The task force was commissioned to look at the current system by the Prime Minister. In its final report, it says there should be what it calls a one-stop shop for all decisions relating to nuclear projects. Rachel Reeves will respond to the recommendations in the budget. Here's Graham Satchell.
When the government set up the Independent Nuclear Task Force in February, it said it wanted to rip up the rules to fire up nuclear power. Today's report claims the UK has an overly complex regulatory system, which has led to delays in building new power plants. In its 47 recommendations, the task force says the planning system needs to be streamlined and the risks associated with nuclear energy should be clarified and brought in line with the rest of the world. The Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, has welcomed the findings, saying reforms are needed to drive forward new nuclear in a safe and affordable way. But campaign groups, including Friends of the Earth, have said it would be madness to rip up tried and tested nuclear safety rules.
Some of the central figures in the recent row about editorial standards at the BBC are preparing to be questioned by MPs. The corporation's chairman, Samir Shah, will appear before the Commons Culture Committee alongside board members Sir Robbie Gibb and Caroline Thompson. Michael Prescott, the former editorial adviser who raised concerns about some of the BBC's reporting, will also give evidence this afternoon. Here's our culture reporter, Nornanji.
Criticisms of the BBC have not only been about how one of President Trump's speeches was edited, but also more widely about claims of systemic bias and political interference. MPs on the Culture, Media and Sport Committee will hear from the corporation's chairman, Samir Shah. He's under pressure for his handling of recent events after a string of resignations, including the board member, Shumit Banerjee, who stepped down blaming governance issues at the very top of the broadcaster. There are also likely to be questions about political appointments to the BBC's board. The Guardian newspaper reports that one of the measures being considered by the BBC in the wake of the row is to expand its editorial guidelines and standards committee. The BBC has not commented on the report, but BBC News understands it to be accurate.
The former Prime Minister, David Cameron, has revealed he's been treated for prostate cancer. He told the Times newspaper that his wife had insisted he go for a checkup after they listened to an interview on this programme with the entrepreneur Nick Jones, who was campaigning for men to be tested after being diagnosed himself. Mr Jones told us this morning there should be a national screening programme. Barry Caffrey reports.
David Cameron had a prostate-specific antigen test earlier this year, followed by an MRI scan and a biopsy. He was then treated with focal therapy, where electrical pulses target and destroy cancer cells. He told the Times newspaper that he wanted to use his platform to support a call by Prostate Cancer Research for screening to be offered to high-risk men. Lord Cameron says there are respectable arguments against a screening programme, but now was a good moment to have another look at the idea. Prostate cancer is the most common cancer in men in the UK, with around 55,000 new cases every year.
A three-year-old boy from California with a rare debilitating condition has become the first person in the world to be treated with a gene therapy developed in Manchester. Oliver Chu has Hunter syndrome, which causes progressive damage throughout the body. His parents say the treatment has given him as close to a normal life as possible. More details from our medical editor, Fergus Walsh.
Oliver Chu has astounded medical staff at Royal Manchester Children's Hospital with his rapid development in recent months. Before the treatment, the toddler was unable to produce an enzyme crucial for keeping cells healthy due to a faulty gene. In the most severe cases of Hunter syndrome, patients often don't survive beyond the age of 20. But in a world first, cells were removed from Oliver's blood and a working copy of the faulty gene designed in Manchester was inserted before the modified cells were given back to him. He's now producing the missing enzyme and has stopped all other treatment. Four other boys will receive the gene therapy as part of a trial. Doctors remain cautious, but the hope is the one-off treatment could be a permanent fix for this rare condition.
30,000 police officers are to be recruited in Nigeria in response to a wave of kidnappings. Officers currently assigned to protecting VIPs have been ordered to return to core policing duties. 50 of the 300 children abducted from a Catholic school last Friday have now been reunited with their families after escaping from their captors. Efforts are being made to try to save one of the UK's most endangered mollusks. Conservationists have joined forces with members of the public to try to find out more about the German hairy snail, which is about the size of a pea. Rebecca Drought has more details.
The German hairy snail was given its name for the fine hairs that run along its slim, round shell. They're thought to allow the mollusk to sweat off moisture, helping to make its slime sticky enough for it to cling to slippery riverside debris and the plants it feeds on. Although first recorded in the UK in 1982, fossilised remains suggest the species has called the country home since at least the Stone Age, and potentially even as far back as the last Ice Age, when Britain was still joined to mainland Europe. But it's now very rare and can only be found in small patches along the Thames in London. Members of the public and experts from the Zoological Society of London are carrying out surveys to learn more about the snail's current strongholds in the hope they can ensure its survival.
Rebecca Drought reporting.
Caroline, thank you. It's now 8:10. A deal to end the war in Ukraine by Thanksgiving this Thursday. That was Donald Trump's latest deadline, his latest attempt to impose his will on the warring parties. If it were to happen by the time millions of Americans sit down with their families to enjoy their annual turkey roast, it would come just 310 days after Trump's original timetable for ending the war, which you'll recall he predicted he could end within 24 hours of his return to the White House. When a 28-point plan was leaked last week, it read to many like a Kremlin wish list. Indeed, some senators claim they'd been told it was exactly that by none other than the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio himself. He denies that in the face of computer analysis of the wording, which suggests that the plan was originally written in Russian and then translated into English, not always completely successfully. Now, Ukraine and their European allies have sought in recent hours to rewrite the plan at talks in Geneva and to extend the deadline too, and there are some signs that they've had success. And they are meeting again, EU leaders, that is, at 9:30 UK time today in the margins of an EU leaders summit meeting in Luanda in Angola. The question it poses is whether reassuring Kiev by amending that plan will only lead to Moscow walking away from the process and us having to wait yet more days as the people of Ukraine suffer through another long, hard winter. We'll reflect on that in a moment by the former chief of MI6, the Secret Intelligence Service, Sir Alex Younger. First, let's talk to our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg. Morning to you, Steve.
Good
How
morning.
Are Russians reacting to what they're hearing and reading and seeing of these proposals?
Well, I mean, we heard Marco Rubio yesterday saying that the talks in Geneva were productive and meaningful and good progress had been made. What the Russians want to know is what the new draft looks like. I mean, if you go back to Friday, Vladimir Putin had said that the original 28-point draft plan that he'd received had a lot going for it, as far as Russia was concerned. It could form the basis for a final peace settlement, were his exact words. But what the Russians don't know is to what extent the Geneva talks have changed that 28-point draft plan, what's in and what's out. And that's what they want to know before they say yes or no to it. What's interesting is that, you know, despite all the optimistic noises that Marco Rubio was making yesterday, in the Russian newspapers this morning, there is a lot of scepticism about this sort of latest round of diplomacy. A lot of finger-pointing, too, at Ukraine and at Europe. Russia already accusing them of trying to sabotage Donald Trump's peace plan. So you get things like this in the tabloid Moskovsky Komsomolets this morning. The European-Ukrainian gang will correct Trump's plan in such a way that it becomes completely unacceptable for Russia. So attempts to force Kiev into peace will continue. And Izvestia says this: in the end, Moscow may receive an updated draft that will be very different from the one the Americans have already sent. It cannot be excluded that in Geneva a draft will appear which contains conditions unacceptable to Russia.
That phrase, or that word, unacceptable, what do you think would be unacceptable to the Kremlin, Steve? What sort of changes would the Kremlin look at and say, well, look, we can't have that and claim any sort of victory in this four-year war?
I sense that, as far as Vladimir Putin is concerned, his priority here is to leave Ukraine as weak as possible and Ukraine's links with the West and Western security structures as weak as possible. In other words, no NATO membership, no NATO troops in Ukraine, no NATO bases. It's unclear what limits Moscow would try to put now on the size of Ukraine's army. 4 years ago, Russian troops didn't get to Kiev. They failed to topple President Zelensky. It doesn't mean the Kremlin has given up on the idea of Ukraine returning to Moscow's orbit or being returned to Moscow's orbit. And I think the Kremlin's calculating that a weak Ukraine post-war will be susceptible to internal upheaval, political change, and that at some point it will turn back to Russia. And I suspect that all of this will affect what Moscow feels it can agree to in a peace deal to end the war and what it can't.
Steve Rosenberg, thank you very much indeed. Listening to that, Sir Alex Younger, former head of MI6. Good morning to you, Sir Alex.
Good morning.
Some looked at these original proposals, so there's no point in talking about these at all. Is that the right approach, or Europe's leaders right to say, well, we've got to work with something, let's work with this and try and make it better?
Yeah, I think that's what's going on, and it's very welcome. I mean, we should be under no illusion, as Steve says, that the original proposals are lopsided, essentially Moscow talking points that would render Ukraine essentially a tethered goat, a juicy target with little chance of defending itself, which would almost guarantee, I think, that the war would restart because Russia would have engineered weakness that it would be bound to try to exploit. So the question now is not really so much is, you know, can Ukraine sign this deal, these 28 points? They obviously can't. It's whether there is enough here to work with as a negotiating framework. And I think that's a good approach. I think none of us should be dismissing this out of hand. It is an attempt to stop the killing, and that's a good thing. But we've got to make it less lopsided.
Over the years, you've always emphasised that what should matter and does matter is the sovereignty of Ukraine as against the exact square mileage that the country occupies.
Very much, and I continue to believe that to be the case fundamentally, and it gets to Steve's point about the Russians becoming uneasy. Fundamentally, Russia cannot afford to have a sovereign Ukraine that can defend itself on their border. And that is the vital ground of this conversation. So there is understandably a lot of focus on this proposal to give up land that many Ukrainians have died defending. I think that's a big political problem for Zelensky. But at the end, this is about a Ukraine that is sovereign and can defend itself. That's much more important.
So in terms of the test in the document, in the 28 points, does that mean that your focus would then be on the attempt by Moscow to cap the size of Ukraine's military, the suggestion that there is a guarantee that they can never join NATO, there's a guarantee there'll be elections coming along soon because they're desperate to see the back of Zelensky? Is it in those areas that you would want to see haggling?
Yeah, and I'm sure that's where the focus of this conversation lies. I think specifically, the idea that Ukraine's army is limited to the point that it can't defend itself is an absolute non-starter and will be being fought really hard in these conversations. And this gets to the key issue, I think, of security guarantees. The strength of the security guarantees is in exact proportion to Ukraine's willingness to make concessions. There are some leaks of a sort of Article 5 light style document that means that NATO and the United States come to Ukraine's aid in the event of a transgression. That's very welcome. Moscow won't like that. But my view is that really the only security guarantee in the end that matters is that Ukraine has got a powerful, well-equipped army and what we call the porcupine strategy. And it must have the freedom to develop that.
The porcupine, in other words, meaning that Ukraine becomes rather uncomfortable to swallow, to take on.
Exactly, yeah. Yes.
Now, Article 5 is in the NATO Constitution saying effectively an attack on one is an attack on all. In crude terms, this means, are the United States willing to continue defending Ukraine, doesn't it? We heard earlier on the programme from the former US ambassador who was talking to Anna, William B. Taylor, who said, look, get beyond what you see in the text, I think we're still backing Ukraine, he said. Do you still believe the United States is backing Ukraine?
Yes, I do. And as I say, this document is welcome. But fundamentally, the document understandably reserves to the President of the United States a decision about whether they would come to Ukraine's aid. And I think that, you know, given the way the politics have swung from one way to the other, it's welcome, but it can't be the whole substance of a security guarantee. It requires it, as I say, the porcupine alongside it. I think it's also worth noting that this is Europe's moment to stand up. I mean, they're already taking an increasing amount of the load. Europe is very exposed to what happens here. It's vital that they show some leadership, and they did in August. It was good. But since then, they've dithered specifically around the provision of these confiscated funds to finance Ukraine's effort. They've got to make their mind up about that, and they've got to get on with it.
And part of Trump's frustration, part of the reason he sets these deadlines, is precisely to say to Europe, look, you say you're going to confiscate these Russian assets in order to pay for weapons. You say you'll stop using Russian oil, but then you don't do it.
Yeah, and I think he's right to put pressure on. I think it's a slightly ungenerous characterization. But yeah, I am frustrated. Ultimately, this has got to be owned by Europe. Ultimately, we are building up the capability to do that. Ultimately, Ukraine's army is developing in a way that can be supported by Europe. The bits are all there. And by the way, I think a central weakness in the US approach is that they appear, Steve Witkoff in particular, appears to uncritically accept this idea that Russia's winning. Now, it's certainly true that there are significant issues on the battlefield, but Pokrovsk has taken them 100,000 killed or wounded over a year, and they still aren't in full control. And meanwhile, the oil price in Russia, the Urals oil price, the price they get for their oil is $20 lower than Brent crude price. That is a lot. Their central bank is selling gold. There's a lot there to encourage those of us who believe that the answer at the moment is more pressure on Russia, not less.
Sir Alex Younger, thank you for joining us.
It is 20 past eight now. The boss of the CBI will call this morning for the government to lift the pressure on UK businesses at the budget on Wednesday. Ray Newton-Smith, who we heard from a little earlier in the programme, says if they are being relied on to deliver growth, then they need support, not more costs to deal with.
The business leaders that I speak to say we can't face a groundhog budget on Wednesday. If we think back to last year, businesses were asked to shoulder a huge burden in terms of the overall increase in taxation with £24 billion of costs per year. We're seeing the impact of that play out in our economy with rising unemployment and slowing growth. So as the Chancellor faces some of those decisions on Wednesday, we can't see a rise of that on business.
Peter Kyle, the Business Secretary, joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you need to speak to businesses today. You need to try and reassure them without being able to talk about anything which is going to be in the budget in 2 days' time.
Yes, welcome to my world. But let me just talk about what I can do and I am doing. Today, I'm announcing the consultation on a scheme which is going to lower the cost of electricity for 7,000 businesses by 25%. They are industrial businesses that are high energy usage, and that will be a big factor in making them more competitive, both domestically and globally.
Rae Newton-Smith did say that those energy measures won't come into play for a couple of years. We knew about them already, and in her words, businesses can't wait that long.
Well, I've already announced the supercharger, which was a few weeks ago, and I'm upgrading that so we get an immediate hit of energy reduction into those high energy intensive industries. That's been welcomed. Of course, I'm starting the consultation now that will lead to those 7,000 businesses getting a reduction. I've only been in this job now a few weeks, but I've already announced £240 million worth of regulatory reforms which will benefit businesses. That's £1 billion worth over the course of this Parliament. We are investing into those scale-up businesses. So British Business Bank, I can announce today, will be investing much more money into scale-ups, doing it much faster than ever before. So we are investing into businesses. We are lowering the cost of energy. We are doing so immediately with regulatory reform. So we have a short-term plan to invest and make it more competitive to do business in this country, a medium-term and long-term on both energy costs, on regulation, on planning, on the fundamentals of running the economy so that Britain can grab all of the global opportunities out there, harness them and put them to use for British businesses, British workers and the British growth rate.
One thing that businesses are deeply unhappy about is the number of leaks that have come out ahead of the budget. And there's another one this morning about a property tax for homes over £2 million, which I'm not going to ask you about because I know you'll tell me you can't talk about it. And I don't think that dance particularly benefits our listeners. However, the number of leaks has been really problematic. The Bank of England's former chief economist, Andy Haldane, was on Laura Koonsberg's programme yesterday. He said those months of budget speculation were the single biggest reason why economic growth has flatlined. It's caused paralysis, he said, among businesses and consumers. That's not responsible for a government that's supposed to be promoting growth and helping businesses.
Well, let me firstly refute that comment. The biggest single challenge to growth in this country is the inheritance this government had. The Brexit deal alone has taken 4% of GDP off of our economy. That is a fact.
But that hasn't made you be chaotic in the run-up to this, has it?
It far outweighs anything that speculation could and did cause. Now, look, just understand the challenge that people like me are in at this moment. I was first asked about specifics of the budget in interviews back in September. So we're pushed hard to give details and direction of travel. We try our best to try and inform the public about as much as we possibly can whilst remaining within the conventions of the budget period. And then also on top of that, we try and respect those conventions. And there is also speculation out there which is wildly out of line.
But what you've done as a government is you've oscillated, and that's made things really difficult. We heard earlier in the programme from Mohamed Alarian, who is a respected economist. He's the chief economic advisor at Allianz. And he told us, just listen to this, that you have caused instability through your bad handling of this pre-budget period.
A budget has a journey and a destination. If you make the journey complex, if the journey seems to some as chaotic, then your destination becomes harder to achieve. And that is the risk that the government is facing. It can overcome it by being decisive on budget day, but it has made hard choices even harder.
Now, some of that is leaks, yes. But when you've got the Chancellor, for example, floating the idea of breaking manifesto promises, floating the idea very strongly of a rise in income tax and then rowing back on it again, that causes huge problems for the economy.
Well, Anna, we just have to see what's in the budget on Wednesday. But I can tell you this, that we'll be doubling down on the cost of living crisis that's faced by
people. Hang on a minute. Sorry, no, you've moved straight away from that without without answering any of those points, that the government has been chaotic, you've not been focused, you chose the date of the budget, which is far later than usual. You have to answer that before you move on to what you want to do.
Well, what you're asking me to do is speculate on speculation.
No, I'm asking you to answer why you've been accused from various quarters of making such a bad job of this pre-budget period and causing unease and unrest, which has slowed economic growth.
Well, Anna, You ask me to sort of say what is speculation, what is not speculation, because what is leaks, what is not leaks?
I put to you the Chancellor's oscillation on income tax. Now, that wasn't leaks. That's something that she did all by herself, testing that out, finding out that actually it probably wouldn't fly and then pulling it back again.
What we have been doing is focusing absolutely ruthlessly and rigorously on the interests of the economy and our country and consumers on budget day. We have been focused on that. Now, in the run-up to that, we get a number of reports from the OBR and other forecasters, and we base our measures on them. Those forecasts change over time. We are under intense scrutiny and intense pressure to try and give direction of travel. We try and get the balance right. But let me be really clear what we are focused on all the way through. Rachel Reeves, myself as business secretary, the whole of government is focused on delivering for the country, delivering on tackling the challenges on cost of living, making sure we can protect the NHS. And then also those big fundamental underlying challenges that we inherited with the debt challenges, the debt crisis that we were spiralling towards under the previous government. We have to tackle all of these issues whilst creating the circumstances while business can thrive. We do that by doing things like the announcement that I'm making today to lower energy prices. We do that by regulatory reform. Already we are out of the starting blocks on that.
Okay.
And we need to get things right into the long term, which is why the industrial strategy has 10-year focus and stability in core industrial policies.
Well, let's talk
very
about something
few countries
before
have that.
You go.
We do, and British business is benefiting from it now and into the future.
Let's talk about something before you go, because I know you don't have unlimited time, and it is the Employment Rights Bill, which will be discussed later on today, because businesses say that they are being discouraged from hiring because of the new rights and protections around sick pay and unfair dismissal that kick in on day one of employment. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, is going to talk about that as well today. Now, you talked about speculation. There is speculation that you might be about to move on the Employment Rights Bill. Is that the case, or is that a hard no?
Well, no, what I'm doing is now defining it. The law left certain areas, the law that's going through Parliament at the moment, which hasn't quite cleared, when it does clear Parliament, and I hope the Tories will allow it to go through the Lords so we can crack on with it, will give me the opportunity to then launch key consultations and engage with business
and workers.
So
might it change from what it is now?
Well, Anna, it isn't anything now, because in those key areas that you're probably referring to, which is rights from day one and 0 hours contracts, let me be honest about it, I've heard the concerns of businesses. I've heard what people in the unions and workers who I've engaged with intensively as well expect from it. But in those two areas, they are then to be defined in practice once the law clears.
Okay. And my that is a slightly different message then from what we've heard previously, which is no change.
Well, as I said, nothing has been defined, so there's nothing to change. So the clear direction from me, and let me be really clear about this, is that I want to get back to the spirit and the letter of our manifesto commitment, which is that this business, these areas will be implemented in a way that is benefiting business and benefiting the people who work in business. We do not see this as zero sum. We can bring this together in a way that brings both together and gets our employment rights and the opportunities for businesses right for the moment we're living in. Employment law hasn't been updated for almost a generation.
Okay.
In that time, things like 0 hours, hire and refire, some of these things have crept into our economy. Lots of people are working now via apps. That was completely outside of the employment legislation that existed. So we have to modernise it. We can get it right in a way that actually stimulates growth, makes productivity in the workplace better, not worse, and can contribute towards a much more harmonious relationship between the people who work in businesses and the businesses itself.
Well,
that's why
we'll
it's welcomed
see,
by some businesses, and I hope that you focus on some of those as well.
Well, we'll see what it looks like in the end. Peter Carr, the Business Secretary, thank you for joining us.
It is 8:30, time for the sports. Now, here is Mike.
Nick, thank you. Good weekend for Arsenal. They find themselves 6 points clear at the top of the Premier League this morning after an emphatic 4-1 win over Tottenham in the North London derby yesterday. Eberechi Eze with a hat-trick, excuse me, in that one. Meanwhile, we're going to talk Formula One because Las Vegas is no stranger to drama, and we saw plenty of that this weekend.
Max Verstappen wins the Las Vegas Grand Prix and keeps himself in this title fight by over 20 seconds to Lando Norris, who started on pole but nursing issues in the final laps of this Grand Prix. Vital points and extends his lead in the Drivers' Championship, with Russell third. Oscar Piastri will of course pick up fourth place.
Or so we thought, because hours after Max Verstappen's victory in the Las Vegas Grand Prix yesterday morning, we heard the shock news that his title rivals Lando Norris and Oscar Piastri, who had finished second and fourth respectively, had both been disqualified from the race for technical infringements. It all means that Norris's lead at the top of the Drivers' Championship is now cut to 24 points ahead of the Dutchman Verstappen and his McLaren teammate Piastri. Well, let's speak to a man who knows all about what it takes to win a Formula One world title. I'm delighted to say that the former world champion Damon Hill joins us live on the programme. Morning, Damon.
Good morning. How are you? It was a bit of a shock. Like a lot of people, I got up at 4 in the morning to watch it, went to bed again, and woke up to find that the result was not as I left it. This is in true Formula One style. We love a cliffhanger last race to decide the championship. There's two more races to go, and total of 58 points available because we've got a sprint race in Qatar. But Lando has this helpful 24-point advantage, but it's not nearly as much as it would have been. So, yeah, Max is resurgent, and he is coming. They call him, it depends whether you call him Jaws, or there's this idea of him coming up from the deep. I mean, he was way back earlier in the season, and now he's closed the gap, and, of course, won in Vegas. Now in the hunt, and equal with Oscar Piastri, who was second in the championship.
Yeah, so Lando Norris still, as you say, very much in the driver's seat, if you forgive the pun, with that 24-point lead. But it is Max Verstappen who knows how to win world titles. He is the four-time world champion, won it for the last four consecutive years, who is coming hot on his heels. And he will fancy himself, won't he, going into the final two races?
Of course he will. And they've not stopped development, it appears, with Red Bull. They're an amazing team. I mean, they have put themselves under so much pressure for so many years. And they, just when you think they're behind, they find another gear. And McLaren have famously sort of stopped their development because they've got this big job to produce totally new cars for 26 next year. And they did have what looked like a almost unassailable advantage over everyone for most of the season. But slowly, surely, Max and Red Bull have closed the gap. And now with this disqualification because of the plank wear, and we're talking about a device that is there to stop the cars from running too low, which gains an advantage. And it's a way of measuring whether they're going beyond that or not. And they were out by less than 0.2 of a millimeter on both of cars. So, you know, it was a negligible amount that wouldn't have gained any performance. But unfortunately, rules are rules. And they encountered an unusual situation in the race that they weren't expecting. So they were out.
Very fine margins, as you say. Just a word on Lando Norris, though, who, as you say, a little nervous, perhaps, heading into these final two races. But if he does hold on to win his first Formula One championship, what an achievement that will be for the British driver. What have you made of his performances this season?
Well, he's always been touted as being a kind of a coming man, you know, a very talented driver. And he's had one or two ups and downs along this through this season. He looked like he was losing the momentum to Oscar, but he's regained that, and he's really performed brilliantly in the last three or four races. And he's put himself back in the hunt, and he's got a very good chance of becoming world champion. As I said, he's got 24 points over everyone, so he's got a little bit of slack. But as we saw from Vegas, you can suddenly lose 25 points. And so it's a very tense situation for him. He'll be working out how to keep his head, but he's done very, very well at that to date. And I think he's confident. We've seen the best of him at the moment.
Norris keeping his head. What's your head saying, Damon, just briefly? Who will become Formula One World Champion 2025?
Well, I am hoping that it's going to be Lando. I mean, obviously, a British driver would be a nice thing to see, but you have this sneaking feeling that Max is They never stop and they find a way. So it's going to be tense.
Max Verstappen on the charge. Two races to go, starting in Qatar for that Grand Prix this weekend. More drama awaits for sure. Thank you so much for joining us there. That is the thoughts after a dramatic Formula One weekend of the former world champion, Damon Hill.
Thank you, Mike. It's 24 minutes to nine. Adam Rutherford's here to tell us about Start the Week. Hello.
Morning, Anna. Have a look at your hands. I want you to look down at your hands and think about these marvels of evolution, these divine instruments capable of such skill and such pleasure. So we're examining the Victorian obsession with hands and what they could tell us about spirituality, about disease and inheritance. So we also have a new biography of one of the two discoverers of that icon of inheritance, the double helix, DNA, not Jim Watson, who died a couple of weeks ago, but of the furious mind of Francis Crick, a man of colossal intellect and a matching ego. And part of his enormous legacy is in the ongoing revolution in genetics, not least because we can trace pandemics that occurred centuries ago by extracting ancient DNA from the long dead. So we'll be talking about everything from plague to herpes. It's chiromancy, fate and pestilence, a bit like a Victorian circus. Start the week at nine.
That was seamlessly done. I do enjoy a trail that a clear amount of thought has gone into. Yes. I'm very impressed with that. Thank you, Adam.
Sculpted by hand.
Yeah. Quick look at what...
extra herpes in there as well.
Great look at the weather now. Today's going to see variable clouds, sunny intervals and showers moving in from the north at times. But we were told... stand by for rain. So I'd look at the local weather forecast to get a better sense of that.
Yeah, you really should do that today. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster. 23 minutes to nine. Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
The United States and Ukraine say they've drafted an updated peace framework. This follows their first day of talks in Geneva on how to end the war with Russia. The former chief of MI6, Sir Alex Younger, told us the question was not whether Ukraine could sign a deal, but whether there was enough to work with as a negotiating framework. And he said it was vital that Europe showed leadership, as it had in August. The employers group, the CBI, is calling on ministers to prioritise growth and spare business from further tax rises in the budget on Wednesday. Its annual conference will get underway in Westminster today. On this programme, the Business Secretary, Peter Kyle, said the government was investing into businesses and lowering the cost of energy to make companies more competitive domestically and globally. A panel of experts has called for radical changes to the way the nuclear industry is regulated to help speed up the construction of new power stations. Environmental groups say it would be madness to rip up tried and tested nuclear safety rules. A three-year-old boy from California who has a rare genetic disorder called Hunter syndrome has been successfully treated with a gene therapy developed in Manchester. His parents say it's given him as close to a normal life as possible.
Thank you, Caroline. Now, more than 250 children who were kidnapped from a school in Nigeria are still being held captive after one of the country's largest mass abductions. Around 50 of them did manage to escape over the weekend and they've been reunited with their families. But the country's military is still searching for the others. And some of the parents whose children have been kidnapped have been speaking about their ordeal.
I am sad. My whole life is filled with sadness. He's my only son. He's my firstborn. Please help us.
Well, Myoni Jones, our West Africa correspondent, is there. Myoni, just talk us through exactly what happened here, or what we know at least.
Well, details are still emerging, but we know that Friday, early in the morning, some armed men stormed this school, St. Mary's School in Papiri in Niger State. They took 325 students and 12 teachers. But 50 of those students, as you mentioned in your introduction, managed to escape over the weekend and have now been reunited with their families.
And we mentioned that the military are searching for them. What kind of capability do they have to actually try and get these children and teachers back?
Well, the president, Bola Ahmed Tinubu, actually ordered the recruitment of 30,000 new police officers to help beef up security right across the country. And he's also redeployed police away from things like looking after VIPs to try and contribute to their kind of core police duties. But ultimately, the problem is potentially an economic one. A lot of these kidnappings are carried out by armed groups that want the government to pay them ransoms. Many officials here have said that they don't pay ransom, but there is a belief by many analysts that they do, and that that's what's fueling this crisis. And so at the moment, there's a real concern that unless they find a way to kind of stop this from happening again, what's happened in the past, which is that you get one kidnapping after another, might happen again.
Miney Jones, thank you for joining us. Dr. Alex Vines is with us too, Africa Director of the think tank, the European Council on Foreign Relations. And Miney touched on it there. Is this all criminal gangs? Is it all financial rather than ideological?
Much of it has become about abducting children for ransom, so regardless of religion. But this particular incident at St. Mary's, I think, is part of a cluster of incidents. For example, there was also in the last week an attack on a church in Quarry State, which gunmen killed at least two worshippers and kidnapped 38 people during a service. And I think that might be linked to something more broad than ransom payment. But ransom payment has become a scourge in Nigeria. It was already visible when the Chibok girls in 2014, your listeners will remember, 276 girls were taken by Boko Haram. That was partly about jihadism, but it was also about seeking ransom payment.
And Miney explained as well about what is being done internally to try and secure things. How much support does Nigeria need from the international community to try and deal with this?
The Nigerian government is looking for support to improve security, both in northeast and northwest Nigeria, but also some of the insecurity it has in what it calls the middle belt. And in fact, the National Security Advisor of Nigeria, Mr. Ribadu, with the Defense Chief of Staff and the Chief of Defense Intelligence and some others, were in Washington last week talking to U.S. lawmakers on the Hill looking for support, which means equipment, intelligence, that type of thing.
What is the broader context within Nigeria? What's the economic situation like that's people say is driving them to this?
Well, Nigeria has gone through a very tightened period of austerity. This has been another of the drivers of kidnapping, which has become quite an industry. But the overall economic picture for Nigeria, I would argue, is one of improvement. International rating agencies have just upgraded Nigeria, and some of the economic reforms of the Tinubu administration is bearing fruit. But that isn't felt in places like the northeast and northwest of Nigeria. Much of the economic growth is in the south.
Dr. Alex Vines, thank you for joining us.
It is now 17 minutes to nine. A scientific breakthrough, which a sick child can only benefit from by flying thousands of miles between California and the UK. We've heard it all before, haven't we? Or have we? This morning we've got a good news story about a sick child from California flying to Manchester to benefit from a world-beating breakthrough in gene therapy. Little Ollie Chu has what's called Hunter's syndrome, a rare inherited genetic disease, like his older brother Skylar. He's being treated by Professor Simon Jones, the lead clinician at the Willink Metabolic Unit at St Mary's Hospital, Manchester. And I've been speaking to him and Ollie's father, Ricky Chu, who's on a visit to Manchester for the latest treatment. He told me when he first realised that Ollie had the rare degenerative disease.
This was last May, so 2024. I have an older son named Skylar that was diagnosed, and we were trying to get Oliver tested for Hunter syndrome. But in the States, the insurance wouldn't cover the testing, so we flew to Taiwan and got enzyme testing there, and they told us that Oliver had the same strain of Hunter syndrome as Skylar did.
So he had the same problem as his brother, and at that stage you just couldn't get the treatment you needed in the United States.
Correct. I mean, they have one treatment that's a enzyme infusion, that's a weekly infusion. So that puts our child on the IV for about 4 hours a day once a week. But that only treated his internals. It didn't break the blood-brain barrier, so his brain wouldn't get the enzymes that he needed. So we searched around and we talked to multiple doctors. They had put me in touch with Dr. Simon Jones, And he talked to me about the gene therapy trial.
As someone based in California, and we often think of patients flying from here to the US, were you surprised to find yourself having to fly to Manchester in the UK in order to get the treatment for your son?
At first I was thinking, you know, growing up in America, I thought, you know, we're the cutting edge of medicine and technology and science. But after coming back here so many times and talking to Dr. Jones and his team, it seems like the UK is way more advanced than we are back in the States.
Well, Professor Jones is sitting alongside you in our Salford studios. Is that right, Professor Jones, that you are able to do things in Manchester that are not currently being done elsewhere?
Well, lots of people are trying to find treatments for different MPS disorders and Hunter syndrome in particular. But this was an idea that came up in Manchester around 15 years ago, and we've been working on it in the background really ever since.
And how vital is this treatment? What is it that Ollie was facing without the treatment that you're able to give him?
Well, Hunter syndrome is a progressive disease, so boys with this condition, and it predominantly affects boys, are born looking entirely normally and then gradually sort of develop more and more complications in every part of their body, their hearts, the lungs, the airways, the bones and joints, but also the brain. And so life expectancy of this condition without a treatment is really into the second decade. So we have a therapy that Ricky talked about that's available in across the world, but that doesn't treat the brain disease here. So we've been trying to develop a one-off therapy, a gene therapy that treats the whole body.
And this is a trial at the moment, Professor Jones?
Yeah, so it's a trial. So we have enough funding and enough gene therapy vector to treat 5 boys. But Ollie was the first sort of human being ever treated with this. So Ollie and his family have taken a huge risk and a huge leap of faith, really, in coming over to Manchester to see us and the big team that we've had working on this for some time.
And Ricky, tell us about that leap of faith, because it's not just taking part in a trial with your sons. It's also just a massive disruption to your life, I imagine.
When we had heard the possibility of coming to the UK for this trial and then another trial for my older son in either, you know, another part of the country in the United States, and how it would separate our family for, you know, whether a short period of time or a long period of time. And we decided we would do whatever it took to get treatment for the boys and whatever was best for them, because that's the only thing that's important to us. I joke, semi-joke, that, you know, I would walk to the end of the earth barefoot and back for my kids. And, you know, coming to the UK is not even close to that. And everyone's been very accommodating here, and I love Manchester. So,
well, that as a boy of the city, I'm delighted to hear you say that. And tell us, more importantly, how Ollie is now. He's having this gene therapy treatment.
Oh, he's wonderful. I mean, he was already, you know, progressing in his abilities, but it was on a very, very slow curve. But after the gene therapy, he came back about 1 month after, and ever since then, that was probably back in March. So now we're 6 months out. His cognitive, his speech, his vocabulary, his mobility, even the metabolic team back in Orange County in California, they were amazed to see him, and everything that's changed since he's got the gene therapy.
Ricky, we wish you best of luck with you and your family. And I can't help asking, what is it you love about Manchester, other than Professor Jones's unit, of course?
I like cold weather, honestly. I like cold weather. Everyone's actually really friendly here. We've been, you know, everyone's very accommodating. They see Ollie around, people are playing with him. And, you know, like, I like seeing the kids around everywhere. It's just a really lovely city. I love it here.
Well, thank you so much for that. We can guarantee you plenty of cold and wet weather in Manchester. Don't you worry. Ricky Chu, best of luck to you and your family. Professor Simon Jones of St. Mary's Hospital in Manchester, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's 11 minutes to 9 now. A new documentary that follows the relocation of 21 black rhinos to save them from poachers in Kenya is being released in cinemas this Friday. And among the extraordinary footage that you'll find in there, there are pictures that capture, for the first time ever, one of those critically endangered animals giving birth in the wild.
There is a place where wildlife rules, where humans risk their lives to protect nature, where rhinos are not a symbol of extinction, but one of hope.
May rhinos be fight over territories.
But if we expand the area of rhinos, we must be worried of poaching.
A ranger is killed every 48 hours. A rhino is killed every 16 hours. This is what conservation looks like.
It's released in cinemas this Friday. Tom Martinson is the film's director. Tom, morning.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
You got just in that 30 seconds or so a sense of the drama behind all of this, because these animals, they need to be protected from poachers. But as the safe areas become smaller and smaller, they turn on each other, which is why you followed the story of their relocation.
Yeah, exactly. So Kenya has done a really remarkable job of dealing with the poaching crisis of like 2009-2010. And as a result, they've had a huge population growth in the number of black rhinos that are a critically endangered species. And so now, as the population outgrows the size of the habitats, they're having to find new places to move them to. The areas immediately around the conservancies where they currently are still have issues with cattle banditry and organized criminality, and so you can't simply open the fences and let them out because the poaching crisis would resurge, and so you have to move them to completely new habitats.
And it's a really delicate task, yeah, as you describe in the film. But I wonder also a delicate task is getting close enough to be able to film them, because they're dangerous. They're strong animals, but particularly to film one giving birth.
Yeah, I mean, so black rhinos are solitary, extremely aggressive. And in order to film kind of natural behavior, you have to do everything on foot and make sure that they don't know you're there, which involves being the right side of the wind, being silent, and trying not to, you know, be seen by them.
Yeah. A little frightening, no doubt.
Yeah, you've got this huge, very aggressive, very dangerous animal, sometimes 10 meters away on foot with cameras that weigh, you know, 30, 40 kilograms. It's it can be interesting at times.
Yeah, I bet. But what you get out of it, through putting yourself at risk, but getting close enough that actually at a moment like this, I suppose it's a story that people need to know about, and to be able to see those pictures and witness those moments, that's what you really need in this noisy atmosphere to make their story cut through.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the conservation efforts that the rangers in northern Kenya have done, you know, they're essentially, they are winning a war that in almost every other country in the continent, they're losing that same fight. And so, you know, those people need the recognition, and, you know, the work that they're doing can stand as a kind of blueprint for other places. But also, you know, black rhinos, because they're so endangered, and they're so solitary, and they're so difficult to film, many of elements of their kind of life cycle has been missed and not necessarily captured or studied before. And so any opportunity we have to, you know, to film something this significant gives us a lot more information about how rhinos can be looked after better in the future.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary piece of work and an important piece of work as well. Thank you, Tom. Tom Martinson, and as we were saying, the film is called Rhino, and you'll find it in the cinemas from this Friday.
This morning from 9 on Radio 3 Unwind, Dr. Sean Williams, here's how listening to new music can aid our brains while there's comforting and enriching harmonies from Beethoven, Eleanor Daly and Robert Nathaniel Dett. If you've not tried that network, it is a great listen. Radio 3 Unwind. Ask your smart speaker. Get it on digital radio. Now, let us turn at 6 minutes to 9 to Civilization. Yes, if you're old enough, you may remember or at least have heard of the great series back in 1969 by the art historian Kenneth Clark. You could be quite a lot younger than that. You'll remember the BBC return to Civilizations plural with the likes of Simon Sharma, Mary Beard and David Olashoga. Well, there is another series. Civilizations Rise and Fall is released today, and across 4 episodes it journeys through the glory and collapse of ancient Rome, Egypt, the Aztecs and samurai Japan. Here's an excerpt from the episode on Rome with Dr. Sushma Malik talking about the Metroid.
The head of a bronze statue of Augustus is a really extraordinary object that we have from the first century BCE. Partly extraordinary because it still has its eyes. We're not used to seeing these eyes. We're used to very vacant sort of eye sockets of our Roman figures, but it still has its eyes, which make it a really fascinating object to see and a really evocative object.
When this statue was cast,
Augustus had just defeated his rivals in a brutal civil war to lead Rome. It was the first time one man ruled alone. And Augustus used this image to cement his reign.
Well, listening to that, and with us here in the studio, I'm delighted to say, is the head of BBC Arts and Classical Music, who joins us, Susie Klein, who's behind this series. Morning to you.
Morning.
You're not nearly old enough to remember the Kenneth Clark series, but it did shape our view of what television can do, didn't
it? Do you know what? I do remember, I'm very generous of you to say that. I do remember seeing it as a teenager. A teacher showed it on an old VHS in school, and I was really blown away. I was a quite young teenager. I didn't really know anything about history of art. I didn't know that I was interested in it. And then Kenneth Clark with this just forensic view and so much enthusiasm just opened up. I remember falling in love with Renaissance painting and things, watching that series. So it is one of the crown jewels of the BBC. I was very precious about looking
well,
after
I was gonna
that
say,
legacy.
There'd be some people think you should just polish it rather than try and make a new version of it. What inspired you to make this version?
Well, partly because it feels like a very significant moment for our civilization. You know, a lot of us are grappling with our relationships with our democracies or our societies or the planet. And we all see threats around everywhere, whether it's disease or war or food security or civil unrest and climate events. These things are happening to the whole of human civilization. And we thought it's a moment where we really need to understand what the human traces that were left behind can teach us, because these aren't new to humanity. All of these crises have been and gone before. They've been dealt with very often not terribly well.
And an example of that is the excerpt that we just heard about the Meroe head. Sorry, I rather garbled it before. What are the lessons we can learn from that?
Oh, it's such a stunning artefact, Nick. It's so beautiful. It's this greater than life size bronze head that was originally a full length statue of Augustus, the Emperor Augustus. He's the first man to rule the Roman Empire on his own. He's super handsome. He looks like, I don't know, Robert Redford or something. He's kind of young. He's got all of these bits of propaganda all over the Roman Empire, aqueducts and viaducts, but statues like this to say, I am the guy. And yet the hubris of overexpansion too quickly comes back to bite him. He gets his forces, for instance, to invade Kush, which is in the Nile Delta. It's today in northern Sudan. And they're pushing all over to expand the Roman Empire. They get massively defeated by the Kushites, who rip this head from the body of the statue. And you can see there are tiny little grains of sand embedded in it. That's because they bury this head under the steps of a temple and they say, we're literally going to walk in the face of your emperor.
We're in an era where people are asking questions what the value of free-to-air television is to everybody. Is your hope that in the way that you saw the original civilization at school, that people will watch it in schools, they'll be inspired to go to museums, they will engage more?
I think there are two things from the Kenneth Clark that we wanted to take. One was, museums aren't dusty. They are full of urgent, necessary, very beautiful things from the past that tell us, that teach us valuable lessons. Go to them, enjoy them. The other is to say that television is a place with technology to impart knowledge.
Now, one last question for you. One of our guest editors this year, from The Rest Is History, Tom Holland, says, not enough British history on the BBC. And you've heard that argument made before. Very briefly, if you will, we'll get you back another time. We can explore it at greater length. What do you say to that?
I'd say that even in my own area of arts and culture, we've